How many members of the committee are in the platform? 1, 2, 3. Hello.
Hi, Chairperson. I only have 4 so far.
Yeah. Yes, I was asking. We don't have a full component for the meeting to start as yet.
Look, Bulabram.
Hey, Boo, Patricia.
Molo.
Molo, Johnny.
Because Babu Kaban to ANC, Lapa, we are not correcting and we have got a very long list of stakeholders.
Yes, sir, I just reminded them to log in.
Chairperson, Honorable Marlam and Honorable Stefan have just joined. We are now 6 members, we may start.
Okay. Let me see. There's a problem with my camera.
Up and down.
That is trouble, yes. I don't know. My children are not here.
Not laughing. It may seem like I'm laughing, but I'm not laughing. it may seem like I'm laughing, but I'm not laughing. I'm just seeing you upside down.
It's a problem. No.
So you're not laughing at the man, you're just laughing at the wound of the man.
He's not quite. Something like that.
From that side. Parliament wants us to appear here on the screen. You will have to bear with me. I don't know what went wrong. You can see.
Until you can sort it out.
Yes.
I think cool.
Because we can hear you.
No. My children will pick this for me later. I don't want to take chances. Otherwise, I will create more problems. Let's start. Welcome, honorable members of the committee. Welcome the support team from Parliament, all sections of Parliament. Welcome our stakeholders, the media, the public, and all in attendance. You are welcome. Today we have got a long agenda because we have got a very long list of stakeholders who are going to make inputs. So we'll have to stick to 10 minutes. Otherwise, we are going to run into trouble with time. And there are many other stakeholders who have just indicated later that they will also want to make inputs. We'll see how we accommodate them. Are there apologies?
I didn't receive any apologies, sir.
Okay, no apologies. Let's go to item two, the public hearings on the draft taxation laws amendment bill and the draft tax administration laws amendment bill. So each stakeholder will be allocated 10 minutes. The first one is Beer Association. They are ready. Their screen is already flighted. Beer Association, over to you. It's, you know, strictly stick to 10 minutes.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you to the committees of finance chairs and honorable committee members. Sorry, Chair, I have to say I did laugh because I am also part of Born Before Technology, BBT. So thank you. I was very nervous. Thank you for making me a little bit more relaxed. Thank you, members. I will try and stick to my 10 minutes, and I just want to land one or two key messages on behalf of BASA today. BASA is an industry organization. We are funded by our members, South African Breweries, the Craft Brewers Association of South Africa, as well as Heineken. And so when I present today, I have my colleague with me, Gregory Marks from BASA, who will be co-presenting with me. I'll do the main presentation. He can then come in when he needs to. He is our technical expert. But I also have our members in the house today online if they do need to add input. But this is just setting the context. We have been in operation since 2019, and it is really to represent the voice of the beer industry in this country. It's very important for us to not forget our partners in this value chain. And we call it from barley to bar because our agricultural input is very critical in terms of our industry. Without our hops and our barley farmers, we are nothing. We cannot produce our product. Of course, without clean water, it is very integral to us. So sustainability is a big part of what we do and what we focus on and what we invest in the country. And then we move all the way in terms of our actual brewing process, which is our microbreweries, which is part of our entrepreneurship program. In KZN, we've worked with the KZN Liquor Board just to train over 100 women moving from a tavern industry into brewing. So this is our value chain that we want to represent to you. And these slides are available for everyone as well. And I'll go into some statistics shortly with you. Now, I would be amiss of me, and I don't want to be negative, but we have to look at where we're coming from. And in my last portfolio presentation last year, I did talk about the impact that our unfortunate COVID situation had not only on South Africa, but on globally in terms of our industry of craft brewers in particular, who are our smaller brewers. They can employ a minimum of 10 people in their brewery and can go all the way up to 100. And if you look at one person and the lives that they support, between 7 and 10 lives, as well as their communities. And we looked at a 3-year recovery period in terms of our craft brewers, and we are only in year one. I also need to say that we still are not getting any relief. We do not get any social grants. The banks do not give us any excess support in terms of applications of relief or funding or payment holidays. So we have, as craft beer, suffered immense loss, with 60% on the brink of closure still, and 30% having closed their doors. Chairperson? So our total economic impact is important that we do create jobs. And this is all these stats are from our BEER's Global Economic Footprint Report by Oxford Economics. This is part of a global study that was commissioned by the World BEER Alliance. It is Africa, it is Europe, all our countries that have got together in the BEER Alliance, and we worked on this report with Oxford Economics. So we are impartial with the results. It's 249,000 jobs in South Africa. We've just taken out the South African components. 71 billion in GVA in terms of our GDP contribution, 1 rand for every 79 rand, and we look at a 43 billion tax revenue. In terms of our spend, the part that I do want to highlight,
Please don't just look at us as the bottle of the beer that you hold in your hand or that you pour into your glass. We also support the industries of marketers, lawyers. We look at canners, bottlers, artists of over 33 billion that we support, as well as beer industry workers are 9 times more productive than average South African industry. Now, this is not me. This is the report that was commissioned by the World Brewing Alliance that has the stats. And this report is available for the honorable committee members. The results of the Budget 22 was very welcome. So thank you to everyone for that decision. The part that did disappoint us is the fact that wine had a 4.5% increase. Beer was 5.5% and spirits was 6.5%. The disappointment is that beer is the lowest ABV. It's alcohol by volume. And in a society where we are trying to deal with social ills, we could not understand the rationale why a category with the lowest alcohol by volume was taxed higher. And this is the one thing that disappointed us, albeit that we were very happy with the fact that our input was considered with our near inflation-related excise adjustment. What we are saying to table is, in summary, we want some certainty in terms of the excise adjustment, in terms of a fixed in line with inflation for the medium term. Even if we know at least for the 3 years we can plan, as I was saying on craft, our recovery is at least another 2 years, we hope, away, and this would help us in terms of our certainty. And we'd also like to stress on the uniform application of alcohol by volume exercise, because if we are saying it's alcohol by volume, then whether you're 4.5, 5.5, or 6.5, then you measure it. And this, we believe, will definitely help in terms of our social harms. In terms of the tax incident rate, if you look at the divergence from the inflation rate of the relative year-on-year increase, it's resulted for us in a variance of 17.03. We have showed this graph before, so I will go through it very quickly. But if you look at this, ultimately, it does get levied on the consumer, and you may think that's great because then it becomes more expensive for the consumer to buy alcohol. The reality is that the consumer does not stop drinking. The reality is that we would rather focus in terms of making sure we use the funds that we get on social harm projects, which we do. And there is a report in terms of the work that we're doing in that area. We are saying, can we at least have support in terms of entrepreneurs? Let's get the economy recovering. Let's make sure we create jobs. We make sure that we have the impact of excise duty and we be able to benefit from that as a community. In terms of this deviation, which we believe it is, we believe we can correct that, and this is our opportunity, and hence our appeal today, honorable members. So I hope I have met my time, and I will leave on this last slide. I'm not sure if there's any questions. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Patricia. The questions will come later, and thanks for saving the 3 minutes. Let's move to the next stakeholder, British American Tobacco South Africa. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. Could I please ask that I be made a co-host so I can present my screen?
Can you make Dane a co-host, please? Let's try to be quick. We don't have time.
Are you able to see his chair?
Yes. You can see the presentation.
Fantastic. So firstly, I'd just like to thank you, Honourable Chair, and the Honourable Committee members for affording me the opportunity to present. I think it's a fair statement to say that in the vaping market, there are more unknowns than knowns. It's a nascent market, and from the large amount of submissions in the public participation process, we can see that there are lots of questions that still need to be answered about the market and the impact of a potential excise on this market. From a VAT perspective, our key point that we want to bring across is that excise needs to be collected from all actors equally to ensure fair competition and an equal playing field for all participants. And there are a few key considerations that we want to bring to the table. And I think the first one is this market is quite a small market, 0.5% of the entire nicotine products market in South Africa. There are a large amount of retailers selling vaping products in South Africa, but there's an overproportioned amount of retailers creating their own liquids, and this is what is known as the do-it-yourself industry. And why it's quite important is that retailers or manufacturers can bring in, say, 10 litres of nicotine liquid, and they could convert this into 1,000 litres of e-liquids for vaping. And why this is important is that is excisable product, and it would cause an increase in excisable product. And any process policy around excise would need to cover off this do-it-yourself segment as well. In addition, there are a lot of products, complex product categories driven by fragmentation, different product types, and there are multiple actors. So consumption in the market, we don't think is greater than 250 million milliliters per annum. However, will this be captured by the tax net? Well, that depends on whether a robust excise framework is put into place, and that would be the only way to actually collect the excise from all actors in the industry. So moving on, and just a bit more on the fragmentation in the space, there are three main product types, one being disposables, the other one being pods, and the third one being liquids. Now, the disposable and pods fall into what is known as closed systems, and these are currently imported into South Africa, so the majority of the products come from overseas. There are hundreds of formats available and different types of products available in the market which would need to be covered by the excise framework. With respect to the open systems, this is where the large do-it-yourself market comes into play. And we see multiple formats, 10 milliliter up to 120 milliliter in multiple bottle formats in this market. So what we need to ensure happens in order for the excise to work and the actual revenue to be collected is firstly we need a registration system that must be introduced with this excise. So similar to other excise types, people in the chain need to register, they need to license. And this will allow SARS to capture all participants in the industry. On top of it, for those of you that know the industry, it isn't milliliter focused, but more puff focused. So people are more concerned on the amount of puffs they would receive from a product. And you don't often get people talking about milliliter e-liquid. So in order for the system to operate, we would need ML markings to be put on the outer product packaging for the system to work, and this would ease administration from SARS's perspective as well, because excise will be specific on a per milliliter basis. On top of it, there's a lot of talk in at least the tobacco space around track and trace and implementing track and trace system to the current tobacco market. But it would also be helpful if a track and trace system with a unique identity code, so this could be linked to excise collection, is implemented from day one. And this would capture all movements in the supply chain and all actors in the supply chain as well. And then lastly, the instrument and the excise system needs to be such that it assists in avoiding fiscal evasion. And when I say avoiding fiscal evasion, it would be to the benefit of the fiscus and to SARS if the excise instrument was such that the broadest possible tax net was initially implemented, capturing all market participants, and excise then paid on the e-liquids. What could be dangerous is if an excise is introduced that's too high, and looking at international examples such as Portugal, this drove people into illicit straight away, and excise wasn't collected. If you look at European statistics, expectation versus actual revenue collection attracts at about 25%. And this talks to the lack of robust excise systems in order to ensure excise collection. Now, we put a proposal forward that the implementation date, which National Treasury said would be 1 June 2023, is actually pushed out to 1 January 2024. Because there are still a large number of questions that need to be answered and further public consultation that needs to take place. And to give a few examples, licensing, what are the security requirements required around bond stores? When will excise liability be triggered? So what is the point of the liability? The payment cycle, every excise industry in South Africa has different payment cycles. What will it be for this product category? Bonded movements, what are the documentation requirements? And I can go on and on, but I think the point is that further public consultation is needed to answer these questions, so when the excise system is put in place, it works efficiently and effectively to get revenue in, captures all players. And then the rate. So if the excise framework is established and it needs to be a strong, robust excise collection framework, then the rate is important. And we have done quite a bit of an analysis based on National Treasury's own workings, and we are of the view that a rate of between 70 cents per milliliter and 46 cents per milliliter would be appropriate. While I'm showing it in this format, we also want to ease administration for SARS and people could avoid paying excise on smaller quantities, especially in those closed systems. So what we are putting forward is that the first 2 milliliters would cover a flat rate, and then anything over the first 2 milliliters would carry the rate per milliliter. But that would have to be between 46 cents and 70 cents based on our analysis, which feeds off National Treasury's own analysis. And then the last point before I close is, like I say, we've done a lot of analysis, but we did commission Oxford Economics to perform an analysis on international excise rates. They looked at South African affordability, they looked at product pricing, and they concluded that a rate of 1.45 rand per milliliter should be seen as the absolute upper limit in South Africa's case. And then when they look at things such as price of product in the market, South African affordability, they feel that 70 cents per milliliter would be more appropriate. And this is important because if an appropriate rate is brought in, the excise system can then be tested over a number of years. There isn't an excise shock, and SARS can improve it over time, and if necessary, the National Treasury could then up this rate once that broad tax net has been established. Thank you, Chair. That's all from our side.
Hello. Do we have British America Tobacco online? I mean, in the platform?
Okay, yes, I've finished with my presentation. Thank you.
Oh, you are representing British America Tobacco. Okay, I thought you are representing Diaper Product Association.
No, British American Tobacco, Jay.
Okay. Oh, okay. Thanks, Jay. And then the Vapor Products Association, are you there?
Yes, I am here, Chair. Good morning. It is a stand-up. Before I start, Chair, can I just apologize? I've had a misfortune. My computer crashed a few minutes before we started, so I'm connecting from a device, and I'm unable to share my presentation, but I'll speak through my points, and I'll send it just after, once it has been sorted out. I do apologize about that. Is it in order, sir?
Okay, no problem. Have you sent the presentation to the secretariat before?
No, I didn't. I didn't send it. I was just going to share from my screen.
Okay, if there's a document, please email it to the secretariat. But in the meantime, proceed with the presentation. 10 minutes.
Will do so. Thank you very much. Good morning, honorable members of the standing committee and colleagues. My name is Asanda Goyi. I represent members of the Vapor Products Association of South Africa. We are an industry body that comprises manufacturers, wholesalers, as well as retailers of smoke-free vapor products in South Africa. We welcome this opportunity to highlight our views on the proposed tax on vaping e-liquid as put forward by National Treasury. In the interest of time, Chair, I will restrict my comments to only the rationale behind the tax proposal, as we see this as being too problematic as a basis for the proposed tax. Our written submission, which was sent early this week, provides a full discussion on our position. The first point I'd like to touch on is the scientific basis for the tax is flawed. Treasury cites concerns that the introduction of new generation products, which include vaping products, may potentially undermine global tobacco control efforts. This could not be further from the truth. Electronic nicotine and non-nicotine delivery systems, which I will refer to as ENDS in the rest of my presentation, have been proven to be a harm-reduced alternative to combustible tobacco. In our submission, we refer to multiple studies which have been conducted by credible international public health bodies, which clearly demonstrate that vaping should be seen as a less harmful alternative to smoking. The view of these bodies, which we share, by the way, is that ENDS should form part of a comprehensive tobacco control agenda, rather than being maligned in the same way as smoking. Treasury has raised concerns over youth uptake of vaping. The results of the Global Adult Tobacco Survey have revealed that the highest percentage of vaping prevalence in South Africa is between the ages of 15 and 24, and is only at 3.1%. This number is low, and it does not support any claim of a youth vaping crisis. The age range employed by the GET study also fails to provide a clear picture of underage vaping, as users over the age of 18 are considered adult consumers. From what has been made available of the report, it is not clear at what frequency, for example, young people between the ages of 15 and 18 vape, and whether their vaping is one-off experimentation or regular use, or how many of those who vape regularly were already initiated into nicotine when they took up vaping, and how many of those have quit smoking because of vaping. Don't get us wrong, while we agree that any youth vaping is not acceptable, we do wish to caution against measures that would deter even adult smokers from taking up vaping. The proposed legislation on tobacco control, which includes ENDS, is at this point the appropriate legal framework to frame the issue of vaping regulation and not excise. National Treasury also noted the issue of gateway theory. There is a concern that the use of ENDS potentially initiates users to combustible tobacco. Unfortunately, no information was provided or empirical studies to back this claim up. We propose that a rigorous study is conducted to evaluate this claim in order to avoid solving a problem that might not even exist. We are confident that the evidence will show that smokers use ENDS to quit rather than to start smoking. The fourth point is the purpose of the excise duty. It is not clear what the projected impact of the proposed excise duty on vaping products is. In our view, this is an inevitable outcome of the nascent phase of the industry, as well as the gaping data gaps in the foundational elements of the tax proposal. Treasury should conduct further assessment of the sector in order, firstly, to arrive at a scientific and balanced view of what ENDS represents for public health, and secondly, to solidly anchor this its tax proposal on an empirical understanding of the vaping sector in South Africa. To achieve both outcomes, we propose that first and foremost, Treasury commission a study to assess and answer the following questions. How many vapers are former smokers? How many vapers are never smokers? And how many of those are dual users? What is the expected outcome of the excise duty on vaping behavior? How much revenue is likely to be raised? And most importantly, what is the projected impact on small traders in the sector? There is a lack of connection between the proposed duty as well as its intended purpose. We believe that the proposed excise duty will be ineffective in achieving its intended purpose because Treasury has not demonstrated how the proposed tax will benefit public health. Neither the discussion document nor the explanatory memorandum accompanying the taxation proposal have demonstrated the gains to be realized from the imposition of a tax. It is our view that an excise duty will spawn an illicit industry and self-mixing of ingredients, which could have horrendous consequences for public health as well as for the legal industry. And the last point is the unintended consequences of the proposed excise duty. The introduction of the excise will have significant unintended and irrational consequences, which are at odds with the intended purposes. Firstly, the proposed excise duty will make vaping expensive, especially when considered against smoking and widespread availability of illicit tobacco. This goes against the doctrine of harm reduction. Secondly, the proposed excise duty will have a destructive economic impact on the vaping industry. According to the Oxford Economics Africa report on the economic impact of end product taxation in South Africa, the tax-driven price increases that would result from the implementation of the proposed tax may see an increase in the average price by up to 138% and cause e-liquid consumption to decline by 36%, and the vaping industry sales could fall by 22%. And thirdly, the proposed excise duty will lead to significant declines in sales of vaping products, and it could trigger a negative multiplier effect to an estimated 1,500 jobs, 360 million of the vaping industry's contribution to GDP being lost, and a significant reduction in tax contribution by the vaping industry in South Africa. So it is imperative that government does the following before its decision is made. Conduct a socio-economic assessment to have a clear view of how a tax will impact the industry, specifically businesses and jobs. Secondly, the South African Bureau of Standards should devise standards for testing of nicotine for products being declared. And lastly, we believe that until the above recommendations are put in place, we would urge the committee to defer adopting the proposed excise duty at this stage. However, if the committee deems that the tax is necessary, despite the glaring weaknesses pointed above, we recommend a tax rate significantly lower than the proposed rate and lower than the levied on tobacco heated products, given that ENDS are less harmful than both combustible tobacco cigarettes as well as tobacco heated products. And Chair, I end it there. Thank you for the opportunity to have our views heard.
Thanks, Asanda, representing Vapor Products Association. As you have promised, please email your submission to the Secretariat.
Will do, Chair. Thank you.
Pleasure. Let's move to the next stakeholder, Association for Savings and Investment South Africa.
Good morning. I'm presenting on behalf of ASISA.
Oh, okay. You're welcome.
Right.
You have got 10 minutes.
Sure. On behalf of ASISA, we thank the Standing Committee on Finance for the opportunity to make a presentation on this very important topic for the insurance industry. Angus, you can go to the background slide, third slide.
unfortunately, the damn thing's not moving again.
Just stand on the presentation and press on the drop downs.
Okay.
There we go. Just on a back background, please. Another slide. There we go. Okay, background on IFRS 17. Tax for long-term insurers follows the five-fund tax approach. The International Accounting Standards Board issued IFRS 17 insurance contracts to replace IFRS 4 interim standard in May 2017. The effective date is for reporting periods commencing on or after 1 January 2023. IFRS 17 represents the most significant change to insurance accounting requirements in over 20 years. The effective date has been extended many times due to its complexity and the massive operational impact on insurers. IFRS 17 will have a material impact on the valuation of insurance contract liabilities and profit profiles, which can lead to a material surplus or deficit for tax purposes on transition. Insurance contract liabilities are a key driver of the tax calculation and are determined on an adjusted IFRS basis for tax purposes. We are pleased to see this basis carried forward in the TLAB. Next slide. Our members view the following as important principles for a tax basis under IFRS 17. The tax base must be protected and the tax contributions from industry should be stable. A sufficiently long phasing-in period of the transition amount and suitable phasing-in mechanism is needed to reduce significant liquidity constraints for insurers, i.e. insurers must have sufficient cash to pay the tax. This is particularly applicable to smaller insurers. A longer phasing-in period also reduces volatility in tax collection for the fiscus. The payments need to align with the cash flows of insurers to ensure industry sustainability. To ensure the integrity of the information, the proposed adjustments to Section 29A must be fully disclosed for financial statement purposes and subject to external audit verification. And the last point, the tax bases need to be consistent between companies and products. Next slide. On the following slides, we will discuss the importance of a sufficiently long phasing-in period. We cannot emphasize the importance of this enough for the industry as well as the fiscus. National Treasury positioned the reason for the proposed six-year phasing-in period provided in the TLAB to be the precedent set by the same phasing-in period in 2018. The CISA members proposed a minimum 10-year phasing-in period. The economic climate in South Africa is currently very challenging, especially after COVID. The additional cash flow impact on the IFRS 17 transition, if phased in over a short period, could cause severe liquidity and solvency strain for insurers, which will contribute to increased systemic risk in the industry. Put in another way, besides having sufficient cash to pay the tax arising on transition, an insurer must ensure that its assets also cover its policy liabilities. Transition amounts can result in a net surplus or a net deficit for insurers. A longer phasing-in period will ensure a more sustainable tax cash flow from the industry to the fiscus. Next slide. The transition to IFRS 17 will result in a substantially more material impact if compared to the same transition, both in terms of the number of impacted insurers and the expected quantum of the transition amounts. The same transition had no or a small tax impact for most insurers. This is not expected to be the case for the IFRS 17 transition. It will impact virtually all insurers, big and small. The IFRS 17 transition at industry level is expected to be about 3 times more compared to the same transition, based on the numbers available from the PwC transitional impact study, which was based on the 2019 and 2020 numbers from the industry. This means that the phasing-in period provided for the same transition is not appropriate. The phasing-in period should correlate with the materiality of the transition impact. 10 years was determined as an appropriate phasing-in period by the Actuarial Society of South Africa based on the outcome of the PwC Transitional Impact Study commissioned in July 2021. This was also their independent recommendation. Next slide. The proposed phasing in period of 10 years is not only to manage unknown solvency and liquidity positions for the industry, but will also protect the fiscus from uneven tax contributions. The ongoing business as usual impact has not been assessed to date due to a lack of available information. It is possible that an insurer has the transition surplus, but that the ongoing DIU impact of IFRS 17 results in a lower tax charge if compared to the old IFRS 4. There is industry precedent for longer phasing in periods for material transition amounts. For example, the 8-year phasing in provided for the locked in new business strain in 94, IFRS 17 is expected to be much more material. Then lastly on this slide, life insurance contracts in South Africa can span long periods. Under some whole of life contracts or life insurance contracts, this can be in excess of 50 years. A 10-year phasing in period is therefore very reasonable based on the long nature of life insurance contracts. Cash flows arise over the lifetime of the insurance policies. Therefore, we need alignment between the phasing in period and contract durations. We note that the United Kingdom determined their phasing in period for long-term insurers with reference to the average range of contract lengths on transition and confirmed a 10-year phasing in period. And then the next slide. The 6-year phasing in period for long-term insurers in the TLAB is therefore too short if compared with the 3-year phasing in period for short-term insurers, especially if one compares the contract duration of the products sold by the two industries. We note National Treasury's concern about administering a longer phasing in period. We submit that the period of phasing in will not increase the administrative burden as the phasing in amount is fixed in the year of transition and merely phased in over the period. I will now hand over to my co-presenter, Melanie Maleski.
Thank you, Liesl. We'll now turn to the phasing in mechanism and other important technical corrections. In the public feedback session on the 8th of September, National Treasury acknowledged that the proposed phasing in mechanism contained in the draft 2022 Taxation Laws Amendment Bill did not recognize the complexities of the Five Funds framework and results in unintended consequences and anomalous tax outcomes. National Treasury therefore indicated that it would consider revising the relevant provisions in line with the CESA submission and would engage members further in this regard. The majority of CESA members suggested reverting to the tried and tested phasing in mechanism, which adjusts policyholder liabilities. This mechanism was used in 2018 when SAM was introduced and is favored for the following reasons. The phasing in provisions were the outcome of a joint investigation conducted at the time by the then Financial Services Board, National Treasury, SARS and the industry, and addressed potential unintended solvency and liquidity issues for the industry. In addition, minimal changes are required to be made to the existing mechanism, the existing legislation to implement the phase-in. One CESA member proposed an alternative phasing in mechanism for the following reasons. It provides greater alignment between tax and accounting and reduces the compliance burden over the phasing in period. This mechanism also mitigates shortcomings of the phasing in mechanism proposed in the draft legislation. However, it should be noted that this alternative mechanism requires phasing in of capital gains tax impacts. Additional changes are also required to be made to the existing legislation to give effect to this mechanism. Proposed wording to be included in tax legislation for both CESA proposed phasing in mechanisms was included in the CESA submission, which was submitted to National Treasury on the 29th of August. National Treasury also acknowledged certain technical corrections required to be made to the proposed tax legislation. The most important of these relate to technical corrections in relation to the phasing in amount, to ensure that anomalies do not arise due to reclassification of certain items between IFRS 4 and IFRS 17, and in relation to reinsurers to include investment contract assets in the adjusted IFRS value definition. To conclude, ASISA members are highly appreciative of the recognition of submissions made to National Treasury and SARS and the feedback provided at the public feedback session on the 8th of September. Due to the material implications and the technical changes required, ASISA members look forward to further constructive engagement with National Treasury and SARS, as suggested by National Treasury in the feedback session, prior to National Treasury finalising their responses to the comments on the proposed tax amendments and prior to the finalisation of the 2022 Taxation Laws Amendment Bill. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Association for Savings and Investment, first day. Let's move to Saika.
Thank you. Good morning, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I hope you're all well. I'll start off
You know self-timing, Sharon. You are almost a member of...
I know. I was best... I know, and I've got my timer on, and I hope he saved you all some time yesterday, so I'm getting better.
Okay,
so again, my presentation is broken up into three areas. It's the policy matters, the technical amendments, and then again, the matters not included in the bill, and I'll discuss that in a little bit more detail at the end. So the two policy matters that we want to raise are the carbon tax policy changes and the changes to the recognised controlling bodies. I'll start off with the carbon tax policy changes. My first concern there is that the rate increases are being proposed in US dollars. And the concern here is that the South African rand is one of the most volatile currencies in the world. And pegging this to the carbon tax rate is problematic because we're pegging it to externalities other than the greenhouse gas emissions. So we did request clarity on this from National Treasury, and they provided some feedback in the workshops, but it is still problematic for a lot of the taxpayers that this causes a lot of uncertainty on how to project their future tax liabilities, etc. And the next one relates to the structure and design of the tax-free allowances and the phase two, where we don't have sufficient detail on what is going to be happening to them going forward. So we would like more information from National Treasury on their rationale, again, for using the US dollar rate, as I said, pegging this to other externalities and not just, you know, the carbon emissions, etc. And then National Treasury has said that they will be releasing a discussion document, so we are thankful for that, and we hope that they will hold consultations to discuss further the design of the second phase, the future of the credits for renewable energy premium, and the electricity levy to ensure that the pass of the cost does not actually occur to the consumer. With regard to the recognized controlling body changes, the proposed change is that IRBA will be removed as a recognized controlling body. And as SARS presented to the committee, I think 2 weeks ago or last week, they said that it should be a simple transfer from IRBA to SAICA because all of the IRBA members have to be SAICA. We want to note that it's not such a simple transfer, and we have been in discussions with SARS on this particular matter. Just because they are a member with SAICA does not mean that they are automatically registered as a tax practitioner with SAICA. They would have to go through the whole tax practitioner registration process, and they would then also be subject to paying a fee, of course, but also subject to things that they were not subject to before, such as the CPD requirements, CPD verifications and audits, tax compliance verifications, and criminal checks, etc., not to mention the SARS induction program, but we have spoken to SARS about that, and it seems they will be exempted from that. So it's not as simple as it seems, and all of this has to happen before the legislation becomes effective. So that we are in contact with SARS. It's not as simple as they thought, but we are assisting members that do want to transfer in that regard. The next concern that we have, and I think that's the important part, is that, as I said, some of these members were not subject to certain things. So the only body that is now left as a statutory RCB is the Legal Professional Council, and we're saying this whole distinction between a statutory versus a legislative RCB, and it's something that we've had a problem with from the beginning, is that they were never subject to the requirements that all the other RCBs and tax practitioners were subject to, such as CPD requirements, etc. So we feel that now with the only one being left being the LPC, it is not time to do away with the whole distinction between these systems. Everybody should be subject to the same regulations, same requirements, etc. So, yeah, that is our suggestion, is to now remove this distinction, make it a fair playing field. There was no mentions of double fees, which is the case anyway. Also concerns about, you know, members having other responsibilities, but our members also have other responsibilities too. So we just feel equitably everybody should be treated the same and have the same requirements. I move on to the technical changes, and there's five of them that I'll be discussing. I won't go into detail in these. I know some of the other commentators will, and it is in our detailed submissions, and a lot of these were discussed in the workshop with National Treasury last week. So I think they are aware of the challenges, and we hope that they will take those into consideration. The first one is the contributors' tax capital, and as we know, the proposed changes are still to a certain extent problematic. It was discussed at length in the workshops with National Treasury, and the biggest concern is that, you know, it is going to hamper or affect the normal share buybacks and preference shares, etc. And yeah, our basic recommendation is they need to ensure that those transactions can still be continued. The wording will just need to be refined. And also, the current proposal leads to practical changes that need certain considerations. For instance, you might have a dividend that is declared and you now have to go back and change it, etc. And how do you do that if it's in a different tax year, etc.? So a lot of issues. I won't go into detail. National Treasury is aware of them, and hopefully they can be addressed. We then move on to the assessed losses, and we thank National Treasury for providing more clarity in the workshops with another example of how the proposed amendment will work for mining companies. But we do feel that there are also, you know, there are many other amounts that are included in taxable income and not necessarily just for mining companies, but for other taxpayers as well. And we do kind of need an ordering rule in respect of assessed losses to be provided so that we get the calculation correct. The Section 72 VAT rulings, so as you know, all VAT rulings, the effective date of those were withdrawn from the 1st of January 2022, and there are changes proposed to cater for some of those rulings that were withdrawn, and those are proposed to be effective from the 1st of January 2023. So there is a year period where taxpayers are non-compliant, and in the workshops, Treasury did ask some taxpayers, you know, have they been compliant? Some said yes, some said they are trying. So the question still is, either way, taxpayers are going to be disadvantaged. So if they have now become compliant, if the changes come into law, they are then still going to have to go back to what they did before. And it's a whole complicated process. So we just don't understand why the effective date wasn't made 1 January 2023, or if it is possible to become compliant, then is this legislation even necessary? So I think that's just what needs to be simplified. But the simple solution is just to make the effective date the date that the rulings ended. Then we move on to the Section 11D R&D incentive. This was extended until the 31st of December 2023, and this is most welcome. And we just want to point out here that, you know, it's National Treasury said there will be further improvements, and innovation is critical, and it's very important because it drives value for the economy, and the role of government is very important here, not necessarily doing the research, but funding the research. And just an interesting example is, you know, Google got US grant funding. Telsa was supported by the U.S. Department of Energy by $465 million. SolarX and SpaceX were supported by public support of various kinds. The iPhone got money from the Department of Defense. The touchscreen got the funding from the National Science Foundation. And Siri was funded by the Defense Agency in the U.S. So the government has a crucial role to play in research, and hopefully that will drive creation, innovation, and get our economy going again. So we welcome this change and hope it can be extended even further. On the tax compliance status, SARS has said that they will revoke third-party access to the tax compliance status of an individual if it is questioned by SARS due to, you know, fraud, misrepresentation, or non-disclosure. Now, the concern that we have here is that the word questioned, it is up to SARS's discretion, and this could be problematic. You know, there could be abuse in this regard. So although we do agree with the proposal, we have a concern that it might be subject to SARS abuse, and we do suggest that SARS actually provides the concerns to the taxpayer and then gives the taxpayer 10 days to respond to SARS's concerns that they have proved. Now, I'm moving on to the last one, which is the matters not included in the bill. And this has become quite a problem for us because every year on year we submit submissions to the NHRC process, we hold workshops with National Treasury, but not all of our submissions are included. So we started asking ourselves the question, you know, is National Treasury even considering these issues? And some of them are not big issues, they're small issues, but still don't find their way into the bill or into the budgets and then into the bills. And then is the minister considering these issues? So we're not sure, is National Treasury sending all of the concerns across to the minister or only some, and then he approves them? We presume it's everything, and then he decides as it's constantly reiterated in the workshops that he does decide what goes into the budget. And our recommendation here is that, you know, thank you to National Treasury who has agreed to have a workshop in early November to discuss all of these so we can get all the old issues out the way and start focusing on the new ones. But I want to highlight four different areas that should have come in, five, but I'll start with the first one. That's the associated enterprise definition. This has now been postponed twice. And again, we still have no further comments from SARS in this regard, further interpretation. There's a draft interpretation that still only gives certain clarity, doesn't give enough at this stage. We've got less than 3 months before this becomes effective. So again, should this be postponed, we say yes at this stage until we get more guidance on what this actually means. The other concern is the Home Office. Basically, I'm not going to go into the details. These were discussed before, but there is a policy concern because at the moment it is inequitable. A person that owns a home will not be able to claim the interest on the bond, yet a person that does rent the house in which the Home Office is situated can claim a tax deduction. So there's an inequity in the policy there, and we're not sure that that was the intention. So we do urge National Treasury to have a look at that. The other one is the penalty for exceeding the carbon budget. It's not included in the bill. They say National Treasury is waiting for the climate change bill to be enacted. But again, that is, you know, we have to then have either the climate change bill. If it's not enacted, we need to extend the expiry date of the current carbon budgeting process, or we need to extend the date of the legislation and include that, because the penalty cannot be included in the climate change bill. It's not a money bill. I'm not going to go into the rest. It is in our submission. I've run out of time, but thank you for your consideration, and yeah, have a good day further. Thanks.
Thanks, Sharon, for representing the speaker. And then let's move to the next stakeholder, Busa. Yeah, Business Unity South Africa. Over to you. 10 minutes.
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Cass Kovadia. I'm Chief Executive Officer at Business Unity South Africa. I'm just going to do a quick introduction and then Happy Kambule, who heads up climate change and environment division at BUSA, will come in. BUSA is a confederation of business organizations. We have representation from every major sector in the country, as well as representatives, representation from organizations that represent the top corporates in the country. Our function is to ensure that business plays a constructive role in the country's economic growth, development, and transformation. So thank you very much for the opportunity for presenting here. I just want to, by way of introduction, say firstly that we are fully supportive of carbon tax. We appreciate the need for the tax. We appreciate Treasury's imperative in getting this done. And we have engaged with Treasury significantly on this, and we welcome this input to the portfolio committee. What I would want to say by way of introduction is that the proposed changes to carbon tax comes at a very crucial time in South Africa, where certainly at BUSA we are interacting with government on some very critical issues that we hope, if we are successful in addressing, will have an impact on investment and growth. The fact that South Africa does not have sufficient investment, both local and global, the fact that we are unable to actually bring about economic growth to the extent that we need to, and in fact our economy is not growing at all, are issues that impede our ability to deal with things like unemployment, poverty, inequality, and just the ability of a government to deliver services to people in the country. And we are also in the process of recovering from COVID-19, which had a devastating impact on the economy. Climate change itself and the move to cleaner energy, all the measures to address climate change and to do so in a way that we have a workable and pragmatic just transition pathway to minimize any damage to both the economy as well as to worsen our unemployment situation, all critical issues that business is dealing with. We see the opportunities in moving towards cleaner energy. We see the opportunities in addressing climate change, including the economic opportunities. But we do need to invest in a just transition pathway to minimize any negative consequences. We will also need significant investment if we are going to take climate change seriously, and we've made significant and ambitious targets. We have committed to ambitious targets, and we are concentrating and working on all of them. So that's the context in which we are looking at the current proposals on carbon tax. We welcome the extension of phase one and recognize the need to increase the rate of the standalone carbon tax, and there are good reasons for doing this. But we do have problems with the quantum and the timing. $20 by 2026 and $30 by 2030 we consider to be too high and too soon. And we would suggest that such prices make sense only after 2035. We also believe that incentives and similar measures are important to assist and support the industry in its decarbonization efforts. A mix of allowances and incentives should accompany the carbon tax. We also need to compete globally and attract investment, and we need to ensure that the enactment of the tax does not actually inhibit our ability to do that. We also believe that the reference to US dollars is inappropriate in South Africa's legislative framework, and the Treasury must reinstate rand-based rate. So that's the sort of context we are working in, and we believe that there is a requirement for a more detailed analysis of viable mitigation and socio-economic implications to precisely decide the right time and headline price. We propose to study viable mitigation and socio-economic implications to determine the right time with the National Treasury to understand better the tax of the income on different sectors of the economy. So by way of that introduction, Chair, and setting the context, I would ask Happy to come in and go into the detail of our submission, which I have before you. Thank you.
Thanks, Cass. And I think, as you've covered most of it, I would like to focus the portfolio committee on four aspects. Really, it's really about the carbon tax rate, the carbon tax allowance and other supportive measures, the importance of enabling a just transition, and the US dollar representation in the carbon tax. I think from what has been said, you've heard from SAICA as well that there are similar concerns concerning not only the rate but also allowances and the carbon, as well as the US dollar denominated rate. We are quite worried about that. But specifically on the rate, we're looking at the fact that the increase in itself is too fast and too soon. we don't have enough subsidies and enough allowances with incentives in order to ameliorate some of the negative impacts that are there. We know some of the negative impacts. Some companies and some sectors are already feeling the impacts of a low carbon tax, but it would be much higher, and it will be much higher in terms of the impacts that will be felt when the carbon tax rate increases at an unsustainable rate, as well as the actual headline carbon tax is quite high. So we're looking at allowances that range from not only free allocations, indirect compensation, subsidies, ring fencing of the carbon tax revenues is quite important, and that is something that we're still battling to actually get an understanding from in terms of Treasury's approach. And also, as Sayaka said, like funding and funding for innovation technology and research development is quite important, but that has not actually appeared. In other jurisdictions where carbon tax of a very high amount has been implemented, you tend to find these kinds of allowances and incentives being placed alongside a very high carbon tax. And that's, if we're moving in the direction of having a very high carbon tax, these are the kinds of incentives, these are the kinds of arrangements that can be supported alongside the carbon tax. So with the carbon tax rate, I think it's quite important that as much as it is increasing very fast, we have to increase the allowances. However, the proposal to have a CPI plus 2% increase year on year seems to be much more doable, and I think most of industry has actually agreed to that as a way forward. We're quite worried about aspects of competitiveness, as Kaz has indicated. One of the key issues here is that in other regions, because Treasury tends to use the fact that this is an international kind of movement, is that in other regions where you tend to find that there's either a price on carbon at the border, so if you have a carbon border tax adjustment that occurs because either the country where the goods are coming from don't have a carbon price, a carbon tax, or some version of that sort, they tend to have as well, in some cases, either a carbon border adjustment tax, or they have a version of a carbon tax. If we increase our carbon tax at a higher rate, very fast, making it unsustainable for local industry, which is based in South Africa, to be able to compete internationally, we will tend to have a situation of more cheaper imports coming into the South African market, and also then again decimating our industrial base even further than what it is right now. So we need to be able to protect our industrial base, to protect the jobs, and make sure that we're actually investing and making the policy environment viable for reindustrialization, as that is our primary aim at this current point in time. So one of the initial, essential and initial points of the carbon tax is that it is one of those response measures that allows a country to be able to either fund a just transition or fund a transitionary process moving from high carbon emissions to a more greener and lower carbon society. Now, the context in which we're working in is that we are a highly fossilized economy and we're quite extractive by nature, so our general carbon emissions are quite high. But the carbon tax in itself can either fund processes which lead to the just transition, or fund aspects that can actually contribute to the just transition, or in itself can help the just transition as a policy lever. Which that, but what that means is essentially that as much as there are international standards or international carbon prices that are there, South Africa can work in a stepwise fashion, in a pace that is affordable, in a pace that is scalable, and in a pace that allows for integration of new technologies and the creation of new economic sectors that will allow for the just transitioning not only of communities but workers, but also starts to address the primary concern of high unemployment and youth unemployment. We are quite worried, and I would not repeat what Syed has said and what Cass has said, but there is no real rationale that makes sense at this point in time why we're linking the carbon tax actual rate to the dollar. A few years ago, we were talking about $10 per ton. Now we're talking at $8.5 per ton at the current rate, which doesn't necessarily give us any sense of certainty, does not give us any sense of predictability, and the ability for companies to plan in terms of what they're going to be investing in is also at risk. So we would like to go back to the rand denomination and work from that basis, because the rand and dollar link is far too volatile. And just lastly, in terms of the recommendations, honorable members, is that we want that analysis that we can do together with Treasury. You've heard a lot of organizations and companies basically saying that there's a lot of work that needs to be done on different aspects of the T-Lab, because we want to work together and be on the same page as to what the trajectory is. So we want that bottom-up analysis that looks at key economic sectors and what the switching price may be. We want to move back from this U.S.-denominated or U.S.-linked pricing, going back to the RAND, and making sure that we're not actually moving towards this $20, 2060, 2026, and $30 to 2030, and just move with the CPI plus 2%, which is, makes much more sense. Definitely climate change is a big problem. That's why we need to have a carbon tax. That's why we need to have a climate change bill, but we can't just do it all willy-nilly without having to understand the actual environment that we're in. And lastly, I think it is quite important that we recognize the extension of phase one, and make sure that in phase two we actually increase some of the tax, some of the allowances, and make sure that industry is protected in the midst of this just transition. Thank you, Chase.
Thanks very much, Busa, for your presentation. The next stakeholder to present is BASA, Banking Association of South Africa. Offer to you, BASA, 10 minutes.
Your mute is still on.
Thank you. Thank you. Good morning. I just want to show my face, and I don't see the option of doing that.
You're on screen.
I'm on screen. Thank you so much. All right. Thank you. Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to be heard today, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. My name is Jean Stegman, and I present BASA on the collateral dispensation legislation. I'm here today as the Tax Amendment Act of 2021 amended the 2016 collateral dispensation legislation, and the draft rules for 2022 made no further changes to the 2021 amendments. So as we stand at the moment, the 2021 legislation will become effective on 1 January 2023. And we are here today just to request an extension of this effective date for a further year to allow for National Treasury and SARS to engage industry. We are aware that, and thank National Treasury for already engaging with industry, but we feel that further engagement is perhaps required. And I just want to set the background as well, is that the 2021 tax amendments have the best intention, and we fully support National Treasury's view that we need to clarify that uses of collateral outside of the collateral dispensation should not qualify for that dispensation. We support that. But we just think that the current drafting does not achieve this. And to illustrate with a very simple example, collateral is obtained by means of a collateral arrangement, and the person that takes in that collateral can then unpost that collateral in a second collateral arrangement or reuse it for another purpose. The issue comes in with the 2021 legislation that if there's a second posting of that collateral and there's default on the second collateral arrangement, that second collateral arrangement should not qualify for the dispensation. Taxes should be paid. We completely agree. But provided the first collateral arrangement is still intact, in other words, the collateral is returned to the original person that gave that collateral within 2 years, there's no reason to not allow the dispensation on the first collateral arrangement. So I think that with that in mind, that sets the scene of kind of what the 2021 Tax Amendment Act does at the moment. So maybe then if I can move to the slides. Just the collateral dispensation was introduced in 2016, and it allowed for the transfer of cash and non-cash, well, it allowed for the transfer of non-cash collateral, sorry, on a tax-neutral basis. So equities, bonds, without attracting SGT income tax to CGT. Provided that the collateral is returned to the original person that gave the collateral within 2 years, and there is a clear benefit to taking collateral on an outright basis as opposed to receiving it by a pledge. As it is already in the name of the collateral taker, if there's default on a debt which that collateral collateralizes, then that person can realize that collateral immediately in the market to recover losses. And collateral takers can reuse collateral. And according to the 2016, that reuse was for any purpose, just but the reuse if it was not in terms of a collateral arrangement would trigger taxes. And that's certainly the way that that industry has applied the legislation up until now or even going forward. So just to give a little bit of background, we do reuse collateral when the bank takes collateral or industry takes collateral. We use it for default to realize to recover our losses. We use it for regulatory compliance, so when we take in the collateral, we will typically uncollateralize it under repurchase transactions with a SARB, with banks, and this is really to comply with our HQLA, our LCR, our large exposure management under Basel III, or also to secure cash funding, overnight cash funding, also interbank or with the South African Reserve Bank. We can always, of course, use collateral to use it as collateral under further and unrelated debt obligation. Just one slide back, please. I'm not done there. Yeah, all right, let me just carry on here. Okay, so yes, so the reuse was very important when we lobbied this legislation initially. There isn't a sufficient collateral in the market to go around, and especially considering regulations affecting, for example, initial and variation margining, we require collateral to collateral our positions under derivative positions, for example, and for that we need collateral to be able to be reused. Otherwise, there is not sufficient eligible collateral in the market in order to meet our compliance requirements. Next slide, please. So, yeah, next slide. So what happened in 2021? Next slide, please. So in 2021, as the legislation now currently stands, next slide. All right, well, let me just carry on. So the amendments were made then, and what it does is it gave us a list of permissible reuse. And it says that we can reuse the collateral purely for further compliant collateral arrangements, repurchase and resale agreements, Regulation 828 compliance and securing overnight cash payments. So the explanatory memorandum gave the reason for the amendment, as clarifying that any non-qualifying use is going to trigger tax. I think I'm just going to share my own screen because the slides are not moving. Can someone move the slides, please? Give me a second. Can you see the screen there? Can you see that? Okay. All right, is that clear?
Yes.
Yes,
all right, thank you. Right, so that was a list that National Treasury enacted in the PAA Act of 2021. And the reason for the clarification or the list was to clarify that any non-compliant use of collateral will trigger tax. We believe it's already clear in the 2016 legislation that any reuse of collateral outside of the collateral dispensation is going to trigger tax. And we don't need a list. So we definitely agree with the principle with what is trying to be achieved. We just worry that the 2021 Act does not achieve this because it unwinds prior compliant collateral arrangements should reuse be for non-compliant use. But our view is the reuse will attract tax. But provided your prior compliant collateral arrangement is compliant, in other words, the collateral is returned to that original person within 2 years and all of the other requirements are satisfied, that primary collateral arrangement is intact. the reuse triggers the tax. Quite right. That is not a compliant collateral arrangement. So we just want to debate the drafting with National Treasury, just to make sure that, we achieve what we thought was the 2016 legislation. Next slide, then. Okay, so just to summarize again, we fully support National Treasury in their recommendation that we need clarification. We fully support the principle that reuse outside of a collateral arrangement does trigger tax, and that is the way that we apply it at the moment. We believe 2016, the legislation at that time was adequate. We are very amenable to including a proviso to the 2016 legislation to clarify that reuse outside of a compliant collateral arrangement will trigger tax. Happy with that. We just want to keep the primary collateral arrangement intact if it is still compliant in accordance with the Act. The reason why this piece of legislation is so critical to industry is because we have to collateralize and perform certain functions in terms of our regulatory compliance. And then also the quality of collateral in the market. There isn't sufficient eligible collateral to be transferred on an outright basis if we cannot reuse collateral. We have the option of pledge, but pledge is illiquid. We can't reuse it. And we have the option of cash. Cash is expensive. And also with pledge, the foreigners are not amenable to providing us with collateral on a pledge basis. Their preference is outright. So what we are just proposing is just a postponement of the effective date to 1 January 2024 to allow for further industry consultations. Just with regards to negotiating reuse, just obtaining certainty that reuse was also always the primary objective in lobbying the legislation, but that reuse triggers tax, absolutely. And there's no point in limiting reuse to a certain a list of permissible transactions, because all reuse outside of collateral arrangements will trigger tax. We don't need a list. And that's also the prior collateral arrangement and what we call a chain of collateral compliant collateral arrangements within that chain should not be caught. It's only the non-compliant one that must trigger tax. And also, if we want to just discuss abuse, what National Treasury is concerned about, then we would be more than amenable to bring in specific sections to address that abuse. And also, we just need to, again, discuss the points about market liquidity, stability, our regulatory requirements to collateralize, initial margining requirements and variation margining requirements around derivatives, the quality of eligible collateral in the market. And we cannot constrain this by bringing in tax legislation that will severely impact the ability to move collateral around in the market. So, yes, and then the last thing is, again, redrafting the 2021 legislation to just add a proviso to clarify that non-qualified use of collateral will trigger tax. As opposed to providing this list of permissible reuses. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thanks, Fasa, for your presentation. Let's move to the next stakeholder, PwC. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. Just waiting for my slides to be put up.
Take money, if you could please stop sharing. Thank you.
Sure.
We are still waiting for you to stop sharing. Thank you.
Sorry.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just waiting for our slides to come up. But while that's happening, let me just do the intro in the meantime. My name is Carl Mandy. I'm the tax policy leader for PwC. Thank you for the opportunity to make these submissions to the committee. We have submitted a comprehensive set of written submissions, which actually include those that we provided to National Treasury and SARS for the benefit of the members. I don't certainly don't intend to go through all of that. There are just two items, if you like, that I would like to draw your attention to and speak specifically on as part of this submission. If we could move to the next slide, please. So while we, let me continue in the meantime while we're waiting for that slide to be moved. The first item that I'd like to address is in relation to the concept of contributed tax capital. This is a contentious issue that's been ongoing since the 2021 amendments from last year. Just as a starting point, I think it's worthwhile just stepping back to remind the committee members what it is that we're dealing with. So contributed tax capital as a starting point is purely a tax concept. It is not impacted by either company law or accounting principles. As I say, it's purely a tax concept. What it is, in effect, is the equity that has been contributed by shareholders to a company. That equity, or that CTC, then is then apportioned, if you like, between each of the shareholders based on their pro rata shareholding. It is not allocated on a per share basis, which is deliberate on the part of Treasury insofar as that's concerned. It's important, this concept, because it is used to distinguish between what constitutes a dividend and what constitutes a return of capital insofar as distributions are concerned. The reason why that is important is because there's differing tax treatment in relation to those two different types of distribution. Dividends are obviously subject to dividends tax, and that might vary depending on whether we're talking or depending on the nature of the shareholder in question and their own tax attributes. And returns of capital are, again, subject to a different tax treatment in the form of CGT as a general principle, whereby that is either reduced to reduce the cost of the shares in the hands of the shareholder, or where that cost has been reduced to null to give rise to capital gains tax treatment. The concern that Treasury has is in relation to the situation where distributions are made on a mismatched basis, if you like, to shareholders, where, for example, one shareholder receives a dividend and another shareholder, rather than receiving a dividend, receives a return of capital. The reason why this might be preferred from a shareholder point of view is because of those different tax attributes that I mentioned earlier. So, for example, a foreign shareholder might prefer to receive a return of capital rather than a dividend because a dividend would be subject to dividends tax, whereas a return of capital as a general proposition would not be subject to, certainly not to South African tax in the hands of that shareholder. And by contrast, a domestic company that happens to be, a domestic company that happens to be a shareholder might even prefer to receive a dividend. So in the past, there has been this manipulation, if you like, for want of a better term, insofar as those distributions are concerned. And that is what the 2021 amendment attempted to achieve and in addressing. And it does achieve in addressing that mischief. The trouble is that it actually results in unintended consequences insofar as share buybacks and redemptions are concerned. Those two types of transactions, certainly in our view, do not give rise to the type of mischief that Treasury is attempting to address. That brings us to the 2022 proposed amendments. Those seek to refine the rule by introducing a new rule whereby any distribution of CTC must then, when there's another distribution within 91 days, either before or after, that must include a distribution of CTC as well. The trouble that we have with that amendment, with that proposed amendment, is that one, it doesn't fully address the concerns related to share buybacks and redemptions. There's still residual potential anomalies and exposures that arise in the context of those types of transactions. And the second, and just as important issue, is that it actually reopens the door in some respects for the mischief that that Treasury is attempting to address with the original proposal, as well as resulting in further anomalies that might arise in the context of retrospective changes to the tax attributes of the distribution. So, for example, you could have what was originally regarded as a distribution of CTC suddenly becomes a dividend with retrospective effect, and the compliance administration and penalty implications that might arise from that scenario as well. So what we're suggesting is to retain the 2021 rule, which does address the mischief in question, but then to provide for a specific exclusion from that rule for share buyback. Let me pause there for a moment. I know that the presentation is not showing at the moment. I don't know if you'd like me to share it before I move to my next slide on the next topic.
What is the problem with PwC's slides? I mean, presentation?
I think the screen was frozen, say. So it wasn't moving. Somehow between Mr. Ekman leaving the platform and trying to put Mr. Menu
on.
You are co-host.
Okay.
You are co-host.
So let me share quickly. Can someone just confirm that you can see that my screen?
Yes, we can see your screen.
So can you see my screen?
Yes, we can, Carl. Maybe just make a presentation mode.
So the next topic I want to address is the carbon tax, and you've already heard from SACA on certain elements of this, and you've also heard from PUSA. I'm sure you're going to, looking at the agenda, you're going to hear a lot more about carbon tax from other presenters today, so I'm going to try and just address the key aspects as well. You would already have heard some concerns around the proposed rate trajectory and concerns around that being dollar denominated. I think it's key that it's clear that the rate trajectory is steep when you look at where we are currently versus where we want to get to in US dollar terms over the next few years. I think what's important to bear in mind though is it's not just the case of those or the rate trajectory in dollar terms, but also the steepness thereof. But also you need to bear in mind that the way in which those increases have been formulated is that it could actually potentially result in significant shocks in both 2026 and in 2030. And that's simply because of the way, as I said, the way in which the actual increases in the interim periods or in interim periods have been formulated as well. So something to bear in mind there as well. But it's also not just the headline tax rates that we need to take into consideration. Even more importantly, we need to look at the effective tax rates, which currently can be as low as 5% of the headline tax rate due to the various allowances that are available. There is a lot of uncertainty in relation to the future of those various allowances. We know the basic tax-free allowance is already going to go at the end from 2023 onwards as part of the carbon budget alignment. We also have indications that the basic tax-free allowance is going to be phased down or phased up, depending on which language you choose to accept insofar as that's concerned. But exactly what that looks like, we have no idea. So certainly beyond 2026, there is no indication of what those various allowances are going to look like. On top of that, as I mentioned earlier, we've got carbon budget alignment coming in 2023. I think as Saka mentioned, there's been no proposed legislation insofar as the penal rate for emissions in excess of the carbon budgets are concerned. So again, we have no certainty in relation to that aspect. And then electricity price neutrality. So Treasury is committed to that for the remainder of the extended phase one, which is 2026. But beyond that, we have no clarity on what that's going to look like. And in fact, even through to 2026, just because of the way the legislation is formulated and taking into account the uncertainty around the headline tax rates, there's no guarantee that electricity price neutrality will be in place through to the end of 2026 as well. The other aspect that we need to bear in mind is revenue recycling. This is an absolutely crucial element of the carbon tax. And so far as the original economic modelling that was done by Treasury prior to the introduction of carbon tax, it was an absolutely crucial element insofar as limiting the economically damaging implications of the carbon tax are concerned. Unfortunately, we have, and I think Bruce had touched on it as well earlier, we have little indication in terms of if and to what extent the revenues actually have been recycled. There is an energy efficiency allowance, but you know, that is a small fry. The amounts are minuscule in the greater scheme of things insofar as when compared to the revenues that have been collected. So we're talking about revenues currently sitting at around 3.5 billion rand level insofar as carbon tax is concerned. If these rate increases go ahead, is going to increase astronomically over the next few years. But we have no clarity on the revenue recycling issues. What is critical is that those revenues are recycled back into the economy in order to mitigate the negative implications of the carbon tax, and certainly the increases in the carbon taxes that we're talking about over the medium to long term. Ideally, that should be done in the form of support to business, and ideally it should be done in the form of support that is directed at the economic objective that we're trying to address. The environmental objective that we're trying to address as part of this, or as part of the carbon tax initiatives and so on. So let me pause there and bring to a close the submissions that I'm going to make at this stage. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks very much for the presentation. SAB, are you there?
Yes, I am here, Chair. Thank you for the opportunities and allowing us to present, given that there were so many entrants and participants in the oral submission. I will share my screen now. Can I be allowed to be the co-host, please?
I have made calls for that.
Thank you, Debo. Let me just share my screen then. Okay, can we just confirm if you can see my presentation, Chair and Honourable Members?
Yes, we can see it.
Thank you. So I would just like to introduce myself. I'm Sifani Banda, and I am the Economist and Excise Specialist for SAB.
We have continued to participate in the consultative process provided by the budget cycle, including the opportunity to provide commentary and written submission into the revision of the fiscal framework straight after the budget that the Committee of Finance had been afforded to tax stakeholder and the likes during the budgetary cycle. This is in particular as part of the submission to Annexure C and Chapter 4 of the budget, which have also been part of through the National Treasury opportunity to make written submission and oral submission to the tax workshops. And we think that part of that process is to get feedback from the Finance Committees and honorable members from this process. SAB has continued, as I stated earlier, to participate throughout the budget cycle. In particular, we will comment on the section of the budget that speaks to the increases of the excise duties on alcohol categories. As a business, SAB has continued to be an economic and manufacturing contributor to the South African economy through our extensive footprint spanning from our agricultural footprint through our hop farm and going through our manufacturing process all the way to our distribution and our downstream industries. We have noted the outcomes of Budget 2022, where the post increase in excise was differentiated. In particular, the wine industry was given a 4.5% increase in excise, which was in line with inflation. The beer industry was given a 5.5% increase, and then the spirits category was given a 6.5% increase. We have noted that the excise adjustment was above inflation for beer and spirits, although it was kept in line with inflation for the wine category. We had asked during the parliamentary public hearings hosted by the Standing Committee of Finance to Treasury as to why there was a differentiation in particular that the wine category was given an excise adjustment in line with the guidelines versus what is afforded to the beer industry and the spirits category. We were given the expert coming from the excise policy, which I've highlighted in the third bullet point on page 57, that wine has a preferential treatment in the excise policy based on its macroeconomic performance or its socioeconomic contribution to the country. What we fundamentally want to highlight, Chair, and to the honourable members, is that the crux of our draft tax rate, our contribution to the draft rates bill is to not only speak to what had transpired during the tabling of the budget and the tax proposals tabled on the excise duties and the increase thereof, but we'd like to point out in particular there are some fundamental inconsistencies in the excise framework that are emanating and showing themselves in the excise adjustment that we think need to be addressed, both and in conjunction with what is being tabled from the draft tax rates bill, by the Minister and through the National Treasury. We would like to highlight two points in particular that we note as inconsistencies in the excise policy. One of the key principles of excise policy in South Africa is, first of all, to raise taxes for the government and for the fiscus. Secondly, to deal with alcohol harm reduction. We have noted the discrepancy in the way in which excise has been levied as a system. So the excise policy has existed since 2014 in two budget cycles. The minister has said that this will be reviewed. It has been 8 years since the empirical evidence and the rationale for the excise policy that currently guides the alcohol category has been reviewed. And we think that these inconsistencies present themselves in the excise adjustment and overall in the way that excise taxes are levied on the alcohol category. In particular, we notice that the beer industry has lower ABV products, lower alcohol content products, and yet we charge higher excise taxes, and where other categories have higher alcohol content products but are charged lower excise taxes and obviously are obtaining opportunity to not pay as much excise as other categories. A further inconsistency in the excise policy is that beer and spirits, as well as ciders and are also charged excise taxes on an alcohol content basis. This is aligned to the WHO, the World Health Organization, public policy design and recommendations on excise policy that alcohol, the formulation of excise policy should be based on an alcohol content basis. But we see this contrary, where both traditional beer and wine are levied excise on a per litre basis, contrary to some of the public policy and public health research coming out from global bodies. We would like to also raise another recommendation, given the space of excise policy and what has transpired over time since the 2014 excise policy framework had been amended. What we have seen in the graph that I am showing on my screen is that since the 2014 excise policy, we have only seen 1 year, Chair, where the excise policy was in line with inflation. Since then, it has been volatile, differentiated, and has departed from the principles and framework in the excise policy. Now, this has created uncertainty for our business, Chair, and we believe that at every moment when the Minister of Finance tables the excise policy, there is a great uncertainty and has made it difficult for us to plan for the year in particular, as well as to plan in the future for investments. So how can we reduce the uncertainty in the budget cycle? We have noted here that the MTBPS plays a critical role in the entire budgetary process, and it sets the foundation and the tone for the fiscal framework going into the national budget. It is focused in particular on providing projections for inflation, unemployment, and balance of trade. What we do notice, however, Chair, is that the MTBPS is very much slanted towards the reprioritization of the MTEF, the medium-term expenditure framework, and it doesn't give an opportunity to table tax proposals. We believe that as a legislative framework that is critical and a critical point of the budget cycle, they should be given an opportunity to anchor the outlook on tax proposals in the budget cycle, in particular in the MTBPS, that would reduce, for instance, the volatility and the tax uncertainty we have received in the excise policy space. Just to round up, Chair, some of our three key points coming out of our submission and in total in this oral submission is to firstly say that there is inconsistency fundamentally in the excise policy. We believe, and guided by global institutions and best practice coming from where countries are heading towards in a new frontier on excise policy, that all alcohol categories should be levied excise on an alcohol content basis. This will not only show itself and reveal itself in the way the excise adjustment takes place, but it will remove the current preferential treatment that takes place in the excise framework and which is emanated in the excise adjustment. Secondly, we believe this move would not only be simple for SARS to administer and also has the opportunity to be revenue raising, given a workshop with both SARS and National Treasury to see these opportunities take place. We also believe that it is also part and parcel of reducing red tape and other forms of supply-side constraints that businesses are faced with as part of the President's commitment to really driving and pushing forward bottlenecks or reducing bottlenecks to investments and growth in the country. Lastly, Chair, I think a certainty and a key part of the excise adjustment and the volatility thereof across the different budget cycle, annual budget cycle presentations and the tabling of tax proposals in this regard has been that it has been outside of the excise policy framework guidelines and it has made it difficult for the beer industry and SAB in particular to plan. We would suggest that the budget cycle and in particular the MTBPS take into consideration fixing the excise adjustment and the tabling of tax proposals in particular that would allow an excise rate to be fixed and in line with inflation and forecasted within the medium and within the medium-term budget space. This would not only give us an opportunity to create certainty for our business, but in general it would reduce the volatility that is currently emanating from the excise adjustment that takes place during the tax proposals tabled by the Minister of Finance. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much. that was Ms. Banda from SAB. And I think there is this strong feeling about how the wines are treated with kid gloves, Ms. Banda. I wonder why the wines are treated with
kids' class. But thank you so much for your input. That takes care of the stakeholders' inputs on the first tax bill, which is TALAP. Honourable members, this brings us to an opportunity for members' interaction with the stakeholders' input, comments, or clarity-seeking questions. We always know that the responses really will come from Treasury. Can I have a look at whose hand is up? Honourable members. Sorry. Maybe while we're waiting for members to raise their hands, I seem to be hearing throughout the presentation that stakeholders feel that they should be treated in the same way in terms of tax expectations. But my fundamental question, which I think Sharon overemphasized as she was presenting for SAICA. My question is whether the different stakeholders have a similar impact, especially on the country's economy, and whether the different stakeholders have had an opportunity to make an alternative proposition to Treasury. I see that, for instance, Lizelle from CISA, they do want their day with Treasury. And I'm also hoping that they will get their day. Sorry, but for them, I have a question around the timing of the phase-in period. Now, sorry, whether because they are stating it for a fact that at some point Treasury sympathizes with them, Treasury sees their point of view, and Treasury seems to want to come closer to them, which is a good one for me. But I just want to check as Lizelle was presenting as to whether the 10-year, because that's what they are proposing, the 10-year phase-in period, is it not too long a period? Or, well, if they could probably come closer to what Treasury is proposing, what would then be their proposal and why, maybe? And Asanda, I just want to talk to the issue of the vapor product. And I was a bit confused at the beginning because of the age that you seemed to be mentioning, which was 15. Correct me if I got you incorrectly, because you again went on to talk about age 18 as the ideal age for people to be considered adult enough to be able to take wise and informed decisions. You not smoking, as it doesn't carry the infamous nicotine. However, for you, I would like to really assist me in checking or sharing with us what monitoring tool you might be having in your own organization. I'm asking this question because we have seen, I'm sure you have too, there was a video that was doing the rounds of a small kid. The kid could have been anything between 5 or 8 years, but the kid was vapor smoking. And I mean, it was not a good picture to watch. And one is interested to know if, for instance, the vapor smoking is less dangerous. Can we talk to its danger? Because if it's less dangerous, it says there is some element of danger in it, but not as dangerous as nicotine. So just clear us here as to what is it that we are looking at. Do we have a safe way of smoking? I see my chairperson is back on. He was kicked out by the load shedding. I'll take the hand of the chairperson, and I'll take the hand of Kenny, Honorable Morolong, and I'll also take Honorable Mabilesa in that order. I will not speak in between the members. You just come in, comrade, or Honorable Chairperson, you'll be followed by Kenny, and then Dorothy Mabilesa. Chair?
Okay, thanks, Comrade Nosi. I also want to ask a clarity-seeking question, and you'll proceed to check, because I've got a problem of network here. We are affected by load shedding, so I'm using the Galaxy what phone. USA and others have raised a very critical matter here. I think we're at the right time. National Treasurer will have to explain this, because I don't understand. We are a sovereign country. Then we refer to foreign currencies to make a reference or base our rates. Why do that? Even though I'm not expecting Treasury to do that, can Busa, who spoke on this matter, expand and others as to why are we making reference to? You are raising a serious concern that you wouldn't like in a legislation that we make things in a manner that we refer to the dollar instead of to the rand. Can you expand on that so that when we engage National Treasury, they are able to explain themselves next time when we meet them? Because I also have a serious concern here. The dollar is not the only currency for exchange in the world today. There are other currencies which are rising very strongly, the yen, the euro, the ruble, and many others. And so I would like stakeholders to touch a bit on this matter so as to empower us as to what is their view in regard to a dollar-denominated rate. Thank you, Chair. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much. I was a bit ambivalent about, asking this question, especially because it is not related to taxation, but I think I was driven by the fact that you yourself had asked it, and it's about the safety of these vape products. Chair, you know, health consequences of tobacco are known. They have been widely and publicly ventilated from time immemorial. We've heard from presentations that electronic nicotine and non-nicotine are harm reduced. But we've also heard that retailers create their own electronic nicotine liquid. How is this regulated, Chair, to guarantee safety of the product? And for consumption purposes, Chair, how safe are these do-it-yourself products? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kenny. Honorable Mabile.
Thank you, Chair. I'm also going to just continue where and Honorable Murolo said, because it is really a concern. Most of the abuse, you know, related, they are related to alcohol consumption, abuse and stuff like that. And we are concerned that, and now of lately, even our young people, you know, as young as 12 years, they are consuming alcohol, tobacco, and vapor as well. So then, I'm just asking, is there any type of education? Because I know that on the content to have written not to be consumed under this certain age, but is there a way that perhaps they can be educated so that if they are going to do that, they must know that it is their decision? Because if not, there's not going to be any some sort of education, you know, I think now, and we're even labeled, our young people are even labeled to nowhere. It's like a country where we can consume alcohol, nothing else, or tobacco, or now it's vapor. It is a huge concern. What can be done so that they are educated? Thank you.
Thank you so much, Honorable Mabibesa. in the absence of any other hands from the members, can I now give over to the stakeholders for some responses? sorry. Can we start? Anybody wants to come in, because sometimes some of the questions cut across, like the question that was asked by the chairperson.
Can I go with a question for asked for the long-term insurance industry about the longer phasing instance we spoke on efficiency? Okay.
Go ahead.
Sure. Thank you. Important point we wanted to make is that the six-year phasing-in period is too short. If you look at the contract length of our business, it can span up to 50 years. And we receive the cash flows for those contracts over the lifetime of the policies. So we need alignment between the phasing-in period and the period of our contract duration. That is the ideal situation. And we're not asking for 50 years. We're asking for longer than 6 years. Efficiency is also a huge impact on the industry. It impacts every insurer. It impacts small insurers. It impacts large insurers. It impacts medium insurers. And therefore, it really, really is a big impact on the industry. And the transition can also lead to a surplus or deficit, which means that a longer pricing in period will protect the fiscus as well as the industry. It's not only the industry, but also the fiscus that is protected from this. So if you ask me, you know, if we can move closer to National Treasury, I would say a longer pricing in period than 6 years, if they don't want to provide 10 years, you know, a longer phasing in period than 6 years would also be acceptable to the industry. I don't know if that answers your questions. If there's any other questions, please feel free to ask.
Okay, thank you. I think that will be sufficient. If members have follow-ups, we will deal with that later. Thank you so much for your responses. Ms. Toy?
Thank you, ma'am, for the opportunity to respond. I think I'd like to just provide clarity on the age matter. So the rationale that was given by National Treasury for wishing to impose the excise was because they said they wanted to discourage the use of vaping products by young people, which they said was at which was, they said that it was high. So what I meant by that statistic from the Global Adult Tobacco Survey was that currently we do not have a clear picture in South Africa as to what the numbers are where youth vaping is concerned. When you look at the age that we denote as youth and access to products, we say that access to products to people under the age of 18 is illegal. So from a vaping industry point of view, what we have done in the absence of regulation is self-regulate, because like everyone here, we are also concerned about getting young people addicted to nicotine, which is the substance that is found in vaping products, same as tobacco products as well as tobacco heated products. I'll come to the differences, ma'am, on these different products. But what is important to note, what we are saying is that we cannot regulate on a conception that there might be a youth vaping pandemic in South Africa. What we are disputing is that there is no youth vaping pandemic crisis in South Africa. However, the mere fact that young people are able to access these products is a cause of concern for the industry. And what we have done as an industry body in the lack or in the absence of regulation is self-regulate. And amongst those tools that we are using is we have a youth access prevention campaign which runs annually, where I think there was someone who asked about education that we put out there on these products, where we are quite clear that our members, the PASA members, will not sell to people under the age of 18. So you've got age verification gates on websites, credit cards that are used to pay. The assumption is that these belong to adults, so you cannot process a payment of a credit card on the system, you know, unless you've got these age gates. Number two, we also have put in place delivery mechanisms where the delivery person may refuse to deliver a product if the person receiving the package is under the age of 18. At shops, there is clear signage that we do not sell to persons under the age of 18. But more than that, what we've done is to incorporate other elements. This is from our own accord as the vaping industry. A particular issue that was raised to us as a concern was the issue of packaging, where it was said that some of the packaging of vaping products may be seen to appeal to young people, the use of cartoons, the use of sweets and those kinds of things. So we've put, again, self-regulation where the PASA members have pledged that they will do away with that kind of packaging, because ultimately who we are targeting is adult smokers who are looking for a less harmful alternative. Of late as well, what we've done is we've joined the Advertising Regulatory Board as an association, because again, we want to ensure that the messaging, that the content we put out there in advertising is not deemed or seen to be directing young people. So that's another self-regulatory measure that we've put in place. And another important step that the industry has taken is to work with the SABS in developing product standards for the industry. This process is currently underway, and we are very, very optimistic that it will move very swiftly, because again, like has been said by a number of people here, we too are concerned about the safety, especially when it comes to self-mixing of e-liquid. And I must add, in those instances where there is self-mixing, those are not legal businesses. Those are individuals who take this up as a hobby. We get complaints and we escalate the matter. But what is important in this area of work, which I think everyone appreciates, is that this is a collective responsibility in ensuring that, one, young people do not have access to these products, where there are rogue vendors or rogue retailers that do sell to people under the age of 18, we need to be reporting them to the association. And when it comes to our attention, we do act on those reports that we do get. And an additional thing, sorry, on the tool that we use, we've employed every 2 months a mystery shopper. So what we do is randomly from our members, we we partnered with an association, an organization that does mystery shopping. They go out there and see if all these tools and guidelines that we've put in place as an industry body are being adhered to. What I must stress, though, is that not every business in South Africa is a part of VIPASA. And we suspect some are not, because VIPASA members have pledged that they will agree to the code of conduct and agree to what we deem as necessary punitive measures when people do not do what is expected of them. So it's really important to understand that with any industry, you will have those rogue elements. We need to just ensure that the education component is really amplified in ensuring that our products do not fall into the wrong hands. And very quickly, on the differences between the video you spoke about of the young person, a child rather, who was using some device, that is not vaping. So in the risk continuum, you've got tobacco, cigarettes, where there's combustion. You've got what they call hubbly bubblies that contain the coal and still tobacco, and there's still combustion there. And then you have the tobacco heated products, which do not combust, so it doesn't burn. And at the bottom of the risk spectrum, you've got vaping products. And the issue of whether they are safe or not, I think, is better understood in comparison to tobacco, because we understand that people smoke because they're addicted to the nicotine, but they die from the combustion. Vaping eliminates that combustion process. So it's really important to understand that when you think about vaping, look at it from a risk continuum, which then gives you an idea of the risk profile of the category, which is what we are talking about. Hence, we are driving the concept of harm reduction as an important public policy agenda that South Africa ought to look at. Our submission goes into far more detail in terms of the differences and the risk and safety profile of our products. I think I will leave it there, ma'am, if that is okay.
And yeah, I think you have sufficiently covered it. Thank you so much. And now I'll give the opportunity to Happy. Happy Kambule has raised her hand to respond. If anyone wants to make a response, stakeholders, could you kindly raise your hand on the platform? Thank you very much. Happy?
Yes. Thank you, Chair. I'll respond to the question around what the sentiment, or rather what's the understanding from National Treasury on making the price, the headline price, dollar-linked or dollar-based. We can't speak as Busa on why Treasury did that. I mean, there were some reasoning that it was given in our recent engagement when we had a public consultation. But those don't stand ground, because there's a number of aspects I think honorable members need to understand. There's companies that are South African-based, not multinational companies. These are ones that are coming from South Africa and do have an export market that they are participating in. And then there's companies that are only wholly South African, and then there are companies which are coming from obviously outside and also based in South Africa. So that we are looking at the carbon tax as only applying within South Africa and not necessarily linked to any other jurisdiction in the world. Some carbon taxes are linked to other jurisdictions, and that might necessitate some form of a currency that they may be pegged to, that may be linked to, but that's only in regards to countries that have linked some form of carbon pricing methodology or some form of mechanism that is there. And that's okay in that circumstance, but that's not the case in South Africa, right? And then secondly, the concerns around sovereignty, I think from our perspective, it's really about confidence, and the confidence not only in that there is a market in South Africa, that there is business in South Africa that's trying to undertake particular changes, but also confidence in the fact that South African business can plan ahead and can make the necessary investments in line with what is affordable. And you've heard from PwC, you've heard from SAICA that when you, as soon as you link the South African rand to something like the dollar, the linking of those two is highly volatile. And any given point in time, it can be an ebb and flow of whether or not the price increases much substantially or reduces at a substantial rate. So that gives a great degree of unpredictability. So in our understanding that if the currency is volatile or the link is volatile and is variable in its design, it does not give a sense of confidence and certainty in what we will need to do. And the mere fact that even the current draft of the EM that Treasury has said is that we need to ensure predictability. The policy landscape and the framework in itself needs to ensure predictability. And that's the line we're coming from. What we are clear about is that we understand that most of the technologies that are coming into South Africa for us to be able to do our mitigation options, so to reduce emissions and to ensure that we're moving in line with the whole just transition and the transition to lower carbon economy, is going to come from outside of South Africa. But there are other mechanisms and means in order to make sure that we get those in here. What is more crucial is that we have predictability on price and how we can plan around those investments. Secondly, is that when the technologies are there, we are able to deploy them with the funds that can be ring-fenced, that can be facilitated, whether it's from the state or whether it's from internally, by ourselves and within a context that is scalable within the context that we're working in. And having a link to the dollar doesn't necessarily give us that kind of certainty. There are other considerations that talk about whether or not we can lead on to the foreign reserves, what does that mean in terms of our exchange controls, and we just don't have the bandwidth for that at this current moment in time whilst we are applying the carbon tax in the first phase. So for this particular period of time and for the foreseeable future, we should stay within the band of just having it in rand terms. That's clear for everybody. We've gotten used to that, and it's much easier for us to actually fulfill the kinds of liabilities that we've been placed with. Over, Chair.
Okay, now that we're done, can we get Patricia Pillay? Patricia, can I humbly give you like 3 minutes? We're running out of time. People are passionate about their work that they're doing. So please give you a minute.
Thank you, Chair. And I just wanted to support, Chair, thank you, the request in terms of engaging with Treasury. We as the beer industry are very open to engaging with Treasury. We have sent a few requests, so we are here, especially about the technicalities that we'd like to discuss. But just to, in response to the social responsibility, we work on a national level with various partnerships with the national departments as well as provincial departments. And a lot of our spend is there with communities. And I'm not talking just urban areas, in deep rural communities as well where the problems exist. This is a societal problem, and what we found, we were just in the communities last week, was that people are drinking because they have stress, they are depressed, they are hungry, and they then turn to these alternatives. They also feel peer pressure as well, and that is why we're also pushing our low and our no alcohol category a lot. You will see the campaigns that have been coming through. And that's why, Chair and members, we are pushing the ABV taxation. I think for us it's very important to stress this point that if you have a lower alcohol by volume, surely there should be a reward for that because you are pushing social responsibility. If I have a product like a beer, which is a 5%, I should not be then taxed at 5.5, whereas my other category, which is a higher volume of a 12%, gets taxed to 4.5. That does not make sense. So for us, Chair, it really is that we are passionate about making sure that the product is enjoyed responsibly. We are contributing to employment and we are contributing to the economy and to the fiscus, but the playing field must be leveled. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much. That takes care of the first part of the interaction on TELEP. Now we're off to TELEP. And the first stakeholder on the line is the World Wildlife Forum or World Wildlife Fund. Yes, they are a fund. K.
Can we give it to them at this time? Please, let's stick to the 10 minutes. And if you go beyond the 10 minutes, can I be excused in advance? I am going to stop you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a disappointing correction, it's the Worldwide Fund for Nature, but this is an easy mistake to make. Would it be okay if I was to share my presentation?
Welcome, Assistant Tsebogo.
I have. Thank you. So just a quick point. I will try to make some time for my colleagues in civil society because there was very little opportunity for them to participate. There was no notice, and they were hoping that they will also be able to make a short follow-up within my 10 minutes. So thank you, Chair. I think what's important for us to say and what is not said in terms of the carbon tax is we need to think of also, we are very cognizant of the position of business, but it is can be an onerous and challenging tax liability, but we also need to bear in mind very, very seriously the timelines we're operating under. We don't have extended timelines in which to do this decarbonization. The International Panel on Climate Change has pointed out that we will be passing that 1.5 degrees threshold within the next 10 years, most likely. And that means that some of these, what are called tipping points, points at which we start getting runaway climate change, are likely to start kicking in at that point as well. And this is very, very important to bear in mind, because what it points to is actually the cost of our continued emissions here. So all of these here are likely to start accelerating climate change, and actually the potential for the biosphere to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere is reduced. And that is a big problem, because that means that even as we start to reduce our emissions, the amount that goes into the atmosphere will be increased because it's not being removed by the biosphere. So the long and short of it is that every continued ton of carbon dioxide that we do put out, is a bill that we as society are going to pay. This is not an option. And currently, the best estimate of that actual cost is somewhere in the range of $185 per ton. So this is a very recent assessment that is trying to get better estimates of the damage that climate is likely to impact, and specifically on economic growth and on economies, from the U.S. National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine, using their recommendations. And it is essentially something that, if we look here at the kind of the detail of it, regarding kind of discount rates, this doesn't look at the specific damages of extreme weather events. This is just kind of reduced growth, impact on agriculture, on mortality. So to put that into perspective, a carbon tax of $20 to $30 actually means that society is effectively subsidizing those emissions to the tune of 2,600 rand per ton of carbon dioxide in perpetuity, and there's a price. There's no way to avoid that. Now, if you compare that to the actual pricing that we're talking about, it's clear that we're not trying to internalize all of those costs. What the carbon tax is designed to do is to try and incentivize change, to make it feasible for these companies to make change. And the prices that are recommended for the developing world in 2020 are sort of $40, from the High Level Commission on Carbon Prices, at $25 from the IMF. And in 2030, we're looking at 50 to 75. And if you look in comparison at the prices that we're putting forward in South Africa, they're significantly lower. Even making provision for the fact that we're developing nations and that we have a special circumstance, the whole world has gone through COVID and is currently restructuring. Nevertheless, the price point is critical. And so WWF actually urges that we think about increasing that carbon pricing in the 2030 time horizon. bearing in mind the near sort of concerns. And when we think about the allowances, we know that Treasury is going to continue to have allowances, and this is an important factor of ensuring that we can still maintain certain sectors in the transition, make sure that we do a just transition. But with the current allowances, the effective carbon price will still only be $1 to $2 per ton at the end of the first phase, which is significantly lower than recommendations, and it is not high enough to incentivize any change. And we can see that it's not high enough because we haven't seen significant investment in transformation in many of these industries. So we recommend that the basic allowance be removed, and that any new allowances have to be predicated on actual action for decarbonization. It is important that we see this decarbonization. And also, when we talk about getting to net zero, which is a critical target for South Africa, which we have articulated by 2050, that means that we need to grow the negative emissions, which not just avoiding our emissions, but actually trying to grow the removals. And the primary way that can be done within South Africa is through restoring degraded land, but that is a very limited pool, and that means that if we are considering that as an offset allowance in any manner, that can only be for those sectors that are critical to the economy and that for which we cannot avoid the emissions. So that really speaks to cement, which we need for building, which has process emissions that cannot be avoided. And for, to a lesser extent, for steel, where we can in the future implement direct reduction through green hydrogen, but at the moment we don't have that online. A point about the sort of the carbon border adjustment and the carbon pricing in US dollars. So at the moment, 24% of the whole world's emissions are under some form of carbon price, and lots of jurisdictions are looking to impose them. And a critical element that we're seeing is the border carbon adjustment. So the EU is going to impose a tax effectively on any imported products from across the world in line with their EU ETS starting in 2026. This is currently against steel, cement, fertilizer, aluminium, but they're looking to expand the scope also to chemicals and polymers and to the indirect emissions for those, which means that anything, and we've seen a similar bill passed or proposed in the US, so lots of other jurisdictions are likely to take this on. So any of these products that we export going into those jurisdictions will already have that carbon price on them, and the importers in those countries will be paying that price to the EU. So it makes no difference in terms of our access either way. We are going to have that. But if we have the tax in South Africa, it means that money goes into our fiscus and can be recycled to help the process of our just transition. And it also means that price points will drive the reduction within South Africa. So it makes a strong move, and it helps us retain our access to those markets. And if we think about the price points that we're already seeing in the EU ETS, at the moment, you know, we've gone over the last year from about $30 to over $60. Those are significantly higher than at this point. And that is one of the rationales that we support, the fact that we are trying to think about pegging it against the US dollar. And so broadly, we're in support of the tax amendment and the extension of the energy efficiency incentive, the extension of the price neutrality, which is critical, although government has to have stronger policy measures to decarbonize the electricity sector. I'd just like to hand over quickly to my colleague from Just Chair, Robin Hugo, to give a quick word, and to also to say that the Green Connection from Civil Society supports our input.
Thank you. Good morning.
Your friend has 2 minutes. Dear friends, you have 2 minutes only.
Thank you for that indulgence. My name is Robin Hugo. I'm from shareholder activist organization Just Share. The position put forward as the organized business joint position on carbon tax yesterday is unsupported by experts and by climate science. Essentially, and notwithstanding delaying the tax's implementation for over a decade, the business proposes that a higher carbon price only be considered after 2035, James has explained why we need to take urgent action on climate now, and that if carbon were priced correctly so that it reflects the actual cost of emissions to society, that would be transformative in limiting the worst impacts of the climate crisis. In short, businesses' arguments ignore the socioeconomic impacts of failing to mitigate climate change, which fossil fuel operations are exacerbating with every ton of carbon dioxide emitted. If we fail to take more significant steps to reduce emissions in the short and medium term, that is going to require steeper and deeper emission reduction cuts in future, with more severe consequences for our economy and the majority of people in South Africa. Thank you, Chair.
So much. You were on point. And can I just check, because Mr. James Rilla, we have World Wildlife Fund, SA, for the name of the organization. And you are correcting it to say?
Apologies for that. We are the Worldwide Fund for Nature.
For Nature. Okay, sure. Thank you so much for that. You don't want to have it incorrectly. Thank you. That takes care of WWF, and now we go on to FASLA. Thank you so much. 10 minutes.
Good morning, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members. I am Melissa van der Merwe, and I represent the South African Securities Lending Association. We're grateful for this opportunity to present this oral submission on the collateral arrangements definition in the Draft Taxation Laws Amendment Bill. I'm battling to share my screen. Please, could I be co-host so that I can share my screen?
You are co-host now, Melissa.
Thank you very much. Hopefully my screen is now showing. I think it's important just to give a little bit of context and background to the taxation of collateral assets to date. Prior to the Financial Markets Act, the only way that financial securities as collateral could be given was via the common law procedure of a cession in securitatem debiti. And this process required securities to be posted into a segregated account with no right of use of those securities for so long as the pledge was in existence. And this really had a negative impact on liquidity because those collateral assets were locked up in that segregated account for the duration of the pledge. There was also no tax impact on that arrangement because there was no outright transfer of title in the collateral securities. So no securities transfer tax and no capital gains tax was applied to the pledge arrangement. With mandatory collateral posting being implemented through regulation, it became clear that South Africa needed a legally sound way to be able to post securities as collateral, but with the right of use of those assets, so as to avoid locking up those collateral assets in these segregated accounts, as was seen under the pledge construct. And so the Financial Markets Act was instrumental in implementing Section 38, which introduced the out-and-out cession of securities. And this creates a procedure for the transfer of ownership in securities in recognition of this need to be able to have the right of use of securities and maintain liquidity. So Section 38 requires securities to be posted to the receiving party in an outright transfer of title so that ownership transfers, and in so doing it gives the collateral taker the full right to use those securities and that in turn ensures liquidity is maintained. However, of course, when we invoke this new structure of a transfer of ownership of securities, what happens is that we have a tax impact, because when transfer happens, securities are taxed via securities transfer tax and capital gains tax. And so whilst Section 38 of the Financial Markets Act had solved the reuse problem, it had now introduced a new problem, which was a taxation of these assets. As a result, in recognition of this, the Taxation Laws Amendment Act in 2016 provided a dispensation for securities transfer tax and capital gains tax through the collateral arrangement exemption. And this dispensation was given in recognition of, firstly, the need to have a right of use of collateral assets, but secondly, that it needed to be economically viable. And this is really because when you're talking about collateral, there could potentially be daily movements of collateral assets. And if securities transfer tax and capital gains tax is imparted daily, it unsettles the economics and the viability of such a process. The dispensation with regards to STT and CGT, which is given under the Taxation Laws Amendment Act of 2016, is going to be very important and useful going forward, given the market is going to experience an increased need of collateral in the financial markets through the G20 mandate to the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision and the International Organization of Securities Commission, which requires standards to be developed on collateral requirements to enhance protection with respect to counterparty credit risk, which in turn reduces systemic risk. These BCBS and IOSCO recommendations have been adopted in South Africa via the Joint Standard 2 of 2020 of the Financial Sector Regulation Act, which will become effective on the 16th of February 2023 and will require mandatory collateral to be posted for in-scope entities for OTC derivatives transactions. The examples that I'm going to give on this slide are just really there to show the importance of the right of reuse of collateral in our financial markets. The financial markets intermediaries, like asset managers and broker-dealers, use financial securities as collateral in order to secure exposures in certain transactions. And in reducing exposures, we are managing and reducing systemic risk. Locally and internationally, market participants and regulators also agree and acknowledge that the reuse of collateral is a really important source of funding, and it also helps to maintain liquidity in the financial markets. So some of the examples of how collateral is used is, firstly, we see that dealers who are able to use collateral assets will do so to raise funds through secured financing transactions, or to fulfill collateral calls in terms of their derivatives positions or transactions that they may enter into with third parties. Secondly, collateral may also be used by the party who receives that collateral for their own purposes and for their own transactions. So they may want to enter into a repurchase transaction or enter into a loan of those securities, short sales, or even being able to liquidate those collateral assets to apply against a default which has happened in the market in order to defray or mitigate their loss as a result of that default. So all these examples really show how the reuse of collateral assets enhances the benefits of collateral in mitigating systemic risk. But further than that, to actually increase the underlying market's liquidity and allowing dealers to be more efficient in how they use securities, and that in turn helps to lower the transaction costs to the market players. So just another little example to show how the current collateral. So these examples that I'm going to give now are to show you how the use and reuse of collateral can effectively create collateral chains, where one particular security can be used in multiple different transactions under the current taxation regime. That's under the taxation law amendment of 2016. And that we can really benefit from the dispensations with regard to STT and CGT under the current regime. So in my example here, we've got Asset Manager 1 who posts share ABC as collateral to Bank 2 for the purposes of a securities loan transaction. This would constitute a valid collateral arrangement under the 2016 Taxation Act, and so no STT or CGT would apply for a period of 24 months. In the second transaction, we see that Bank 2 uses that same share ABC in posting collateral to FSP3 for the purpose of the repo transaction. Again, that is considered a collateral arrangement. It's subject to a dispensation for STT and CGT for a period of 24 months. In transaction 3, we see FSP3 uses that same share ABC to post collateral in terms of a derivatives position to broker dealer number 4. Again, collateral arrangement and an STT-CGT exemption for a period of 24 months. What happens in transaction 4 is interesting because we have seen in the example that FSB3 has triggered an event of default. So what broker dealer 4 wants to do is they want to use the collateral assets in the form of that share ABC, and they want to sell that asset to Bank 5 to defray their losses as a result of the event of default that FSP3 has triggered. And when they do that, that does not constitute a transaction which is subject to STT and CGT dispensation. And therefore, STT and CGT will apply to that fourth transaction. That is how the current taxation law applies.
And in conclusion, Melissa?
The collateral arrangement definition is amended in the TLAB such that the way it's drafted is that the reuse of collateral forms part of the exception or exclusion, and in so doing creates an unintended consequence of excluding all previous compliant collateral arrangements from the STT-CGT exemption. So via my diagram here, the minute under the proposed amendment in the TLAB, when that sale of share ABC happens, instead of STT-CGT only applying to that transaction, it actually retrospectively applies STT and CGT to all previous transactions, 1, 2, and 3, such that the market players, through no decision of their own, are now subject to a tax that they had not taken into consideration. And it is therefore Sadler's submission, in conclusion, that including the reuse of collateral prohibition in the TLAB as a proviso to the definition would have the required effect of ensuring that that clarifying any arrangement that fails to meet the collateral arrangement definition would not benefit from STT, but that any prior compliance transactions would continue to benefit from STT and CGT dispensations. And I think that the concern is that if this amendment is not made, it will force the market to either revert to using cash only as collateral, which could cause a liquidity squeeze, or could revert to using that pledge construct, which locks up the collateral assets and again limits the right of reuse.
Thank you, Melissa. Thank you. Point taken, my dear. I'm so sorry to do this to you, but hoping that you were indeed concluding as you said you were. I'm sorry for that, but thanks so much for your presentation. The next stakeholder to present is Sasol, and they have asked Beauty to be made a co-host,
And I'm hoping that you have been able to do that for him, for them. And the name is Mpolisi. Over to you, Sasson. Get on the work on your presentation. We can see on the screen. Your 10 minutes start now.
Thank you kindly. I will be sharing the presentation. However, Henry Russo will be giving the will be speaking on our behalf. Is he able to unmute?
Good morning, everyone. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you, Henry.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair, honourable members. It's a privilege to be here presenting SASL today. We're presenting on the proposed carbon tax amendments. Just a big thank you to the engagement. I think there's been constructive engagement from National Treasury on the matter, which we believe is of critical importance, not only to industries in South Africa, but more broadly the South African economy and the people of South Africa. Just to introduce some of my key colleagues also on the line, we've got Vio Kala. He's our Executive Director of SASL and Head of Strategy. Also Charlotte Mukwena, she's EVP of HR and Stakeholder Relations. And also my colleague Priscilla Mabulane, she's EVP of our Energy Business. Thank you. The next slide, please. Just in summary, what you all hear today, firstly, that SASL is on track to already reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by 2030, by 30%, and we are absolutely committed to a green transition of our business, and also to support a green transition of the South African economy. We believe we play a critical role in the broader transition of the South African economy. Secondly, the proposed carbon tax does render SASL unviable by 2029, and I'll share some analysis which was also confirmed by independent market analysts. Thirdly, and I think this is important, we believe that the carbon tax should be integrated into broader climate change policy, and this should balance people, planet, and profit. And that's an important aspect as we not only face a looming global climate crisis, but South Africa is today facing significant unemployment. We've got a poverty crisis. We've got an economic growth crisis. And this all needs to be balanced more broadly in any legislation that we consider. Fourthly, we believe that any trajectory of increased carbon tax and regulations should be synchronized with mitigation measures. I think some of the other submissions also spoke about the availability of mitigation measures, but they should recognize that the world is currently in a global energy crisis, and the availability of mitigation measures, whether it's technology, solar panels, these are significantly impeded at the moment, and we're seeing significant U-turns in policy in the Western world, Europe, for example. Lastly, we are proposing that allowances and incentives should be part of a suite of enabling policies. So let's not just do a carbon tax as a stick that will deindustrialize South Africa, but let's also consider carrots to reindustrialize a green economy in South Africa, and to ensure that there's a proper and a just transition. Next slide, please. I'm not going to go through the detail, but I think we all realize that SASL is a strong contributor to the South African economy. We're about 20% owned by government through the PIC and the IDC. And although we're mostly based in South Africa, we have a global business with operations in 22 countries and employ kind of nearly 30,000 people. Perhaps just to note, we've got operations in the U.S. At the moment, we don't pay any carbon tax in the U.S. We also have operations in Europe where our current carbon tax is actually dwarfed by our current South African carbon tax. We're paying significantly higher taxes in South Africa because of European the countries allowing significantly more offsets. There's mitigation measures available in Europe. And I think we've got to carefully consider what is just for South Africa in terms of a carbon tax proposal. Importantly, SASL has approved 15 to 25 billion rand already to decarbonize our business. And this supports and actually exceeds the lower end of South Africa's NDC. We're also a major player in investing in future green hydrogen and low carbon growth projects. So, for example, our Buchubai study that's looking at a big hydrogen project in the Northern Cape is a key part of what we see beyond 2030 as a solution for South Africa. So in short, we believe that the carbon tax puts our base business and this transition at risk. Next slide, please, Storm. As I've noted, Sasol is absolutely committed to decarbonizing our business, and we believe that there needs to be a just transition that's balanced. The key four areas that form parts of this journey is highlighted here. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go through all of it. Perhaps just to mention that our renewables program is one of the biggest private IPP programs in South Africa at the moment. We are also investing more than $1 billion at the moment in gas in Mozambique as a transition feedstock for energy requirements in South Africa. We believe that that forms an important part of the journey ahead of us. Next slide, please. In terms of our journey, as I've mentioned, we've got already committed targets for 2030. We also have a net zero ambition by 2050, and we are investing significantly in technologies that will enable us to transition beyond gas into other renewable feedstocks. Perhaps as people should know, Sasol is one of the biggest coal miners in South Africa. So we mine about 40 million tons of coal. In contrast to several other companies that export significant quantities of coal, 95% of our coal is actually used and beneficiated inside of South Africa. And we use the coal to produce fuels, oils, tars, and chemicals that improves the daily lives of South Africa. We will slowly reduce our reliance on coal, shifting to gas, and ultimately we are looking at solutions then beyond 2030 into aspects such as green hydrogen and other renewable feedstocks to continue this decarbonisation journey. Thank you. Next slide, please. Honourable members, despite our commitment to transform our business, the proposed carbon tax threatens the viability of our business. It's a bit like trying to run the comrades and to achieve a greener business, and now someone's hitting you with a big stick. The proposed carbon tax would result in a potential tax liability of around 20 to 30 billion rand per year. This is nearly triple our current South African income tax payment that we gave last year in the year of record profits. To illustrate the severity of that 20 to 30 billion rand tax liability, this would have exceeded our pre-tax profits in 5 out of the last 10 years. So a significant impact on the viability of our business. The impact would be a premature closing of part or all of our South African operations with an associated loss in employment, social development, and of course just more broader tax receipts, which we are paying at the moment anyway. Perhaps worth noting, Chair, that this is not a facile analysis trying to be melodramatic. This is confirmed by independent market analysts, likes of UBS, Standard Bank, APSA, that closely tracks the financial viability of our company, and we're very happy to share more detail around the analysis performed in our own modeling and of that of the external commentators. The next slide, please. So to conclude with some practical recommendations, I think it's important that we don't only offer critique and concerns, but that we move into what is practically able to and viable for the country, given the people, planet, and profit challenges that we've got. So to reiterate, Sasol is absolutely supportive of carbon pricing and that our operations must be regulated. We are not able, though, to afford the proposed carbon taxes. To that extent, we are recommending the following 5 points that we believe will moderate the impact but still allow a just transition. Firstly, we do think that there's a reconsideration of timing of the implementation, especially given the significant local and global uncertainties. For example, to just add a factoid, I was in Germany last week visiting our German operations. We're now seeing that Germany is starting to burn coal again due to energy shortages. South Africa is also facing significant security of supply aspects with energy. And we believe that our timing of carbon tax should really be carefully considered given the global uncertainty. Secondly, let's set a carbon trajectory that's appropriate and meaningful, with punitive taxes applied should a company breach such a path. So practically, we are running the Comrades as FASL. We are absolutely committed to decarbonisation, but let's not be hit by a stick whilst we're trying to run this business. And I think more broadly, that trajectory should also be then applied to other companies in terms of the appropriateness of their journey. For example, the cement industry, the mining industry, the steel industry in South Africa all will have different abilities to mitigate carbon emissions. And I think that point was also raised previously by some of the other co-presenters. I think thirdly, the retention of allowances is critical, and that links to the previous point.
Conclude a bit faster, Mr. Rousseau. Conclude a bit faster.
Thank you, Chair. I think the retention of allowance is critical and should recognize the different sectors. Fourthly, the incentives are important. So as we are running the Comrades, don't hit us with a stick, offer us some water. And we've seen significant moves by the US, Europe as well, to incentivize. So ironically, the US is giving carrots before they're handing out sticks. And just lastly, there needs to be clear alignment of carbon taxes with carbon budgets and more broader climate change bills or other regulatory tools. Chair, I hope that is within my time budget, and I thank you for the opportunity. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Andre Rousseau. That was indeed within your time that you budgeted for. We'll give over now to, thank you so much, we'll give over to Mineral Council, 10 minutes, and your 10 minutes starts now. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair and the committee members, for the opportunity to present on behalf of the Minerals Council. My name is Stefina Mudau. I head the Environment Department at the Minerals Council, and I will be making the presentation on behalf of the Minerals Council. Next slide, please. Chair, I won't go through the outline of the presentation. I will just simply go into the focus of the presentation. We have made written submission on the entire TLEP. However, our presentation today will primarily focus on the issues pertaining to the proposed amendments to the carbon tax. Perhaps our starting point would be, or departure point would be, just to emphasize the Minerals Council position on climate change. I must commend WUSA has sort of painted a very good background around business position on this, which the Minerals Council pretty much aligned to that. However, just to emphasize that as the mining industry, we acknowledge the seriousness of the global challenge of climate change and also the long-term implication that this has on all life and also on the infrastructure on Earth. With these, we support the long-term goals and actions set through the Paris Agreement, Glasgow Climate Pact, under the UNFCCC, and also various South Africa's response policy measures that have been reintroduced that also includes carbon tax. And in principle, we support, as the Minerals Council, we agree with the rationale of the introduction of carbon tax and the implementation of carbon price through carbon tax. Next slide, please. As I've indicated earlier on, our presentation will pretty much focus on some of the critical concerns from the mining industry in as far as the proposed amendments to the carbon tax are concerned. And the first critical issue that we would like to highlight here is the proposed high carbon tax rate trajectory, which is affected or set at the more at a dollar exchange currency. And the key issue of concern with regards to the setting of the, or the pegging of the carbon tax rate using the dollar currency, and in line with what Busa has shared with us, we are concerned as the mining industry on the adverse and unintended consequences that this has on the mining tax payers. And as a result, our concern stems from the constant volatility of the rand-dollar exchange, which will effectively hinder the ability of the most mining companies to plan and, most importantly, budget effectively for their tax liabilities. The second issue that I want to raise here pertains to the fact that the rand has depreciated more than 100% since 2008, and consequently, setting the carbon tax rate to US dollar will result in a mammoth surge in the taxes from the mining industry in the coming years, therefore severely impacting on the viability of some of the mining operations. To this effect, we also want to mention as a matter of principle that setting carbon tax rate to rand-dollar exchange demonstrates National Treasury's lack of confidence in the South African rand as a currency. And most importantly, this contradicts the principles of certainty and predictability as highlighted in the National Treasury explanatory memorandum that accompanies the draft TLEP bill. The second point that we want to raise on the proposed carbon tax rate trajectory relates to the financial impact that the proposed higher tax rate has on the mining industry. And here I will just focus on the high level principle to allow my colleague, Mr. Bongani Mota, to deep dive into some preliminary results of the modeling that we've done to understand the financial impact of the proposed high tax rate on the mining industry. And as a matter of principle, here just to mention that mining companies that belong to the Minerals Council have been implementing significant measures to reduce carbon emissions, therefore requiring them to incur substantial upfront capital investment costs, which they have absorbed so far, and adding to this potential, with the potential removal of the allowances, which we understand is imminent, this will erode the capital investment aimed at the implementation of other mitigation measures going forward. So the second point on the financial impact is also to state that the proposed high tax rate will severely impact on the viability of most of the mining operations that belong to the Minerals Council, and especially those that are energy and carbon intensive, leaving them very little window for opportunity to implement the cost-effective mitigation options. The third point that I want to highlight looks at the fact that the increase in the input cost of mining companies that have been seen indirectly through the increase in supplier prices, as well as that will result in the rising carbon tax rate to which that they will be subjected to. And I think the fourth critical point here to highlight is the peculiar circumstance that the mining industry finds itself in from the perspective of the fact that the industry is a price taker and will therefore be unable to transfer the cost of carbon tax price of the commodities. And another important key consideration here is the fact that the suppliers to the mining industry have already been able to transfer their cost of carbon tax to the mining industry, which has significantly increase the cost of doing business. And with the proposed higher carbon tax rate, we are also foreseeing quite a dire impact on the viability of some of the marginal mines, and may even be enough to render such mines unprofitable and consequently lead to premature closure. Still on the financial impact of the proposed higher tax rate, here I think we just want to make a submission that we recommend that the domestic carbon price should be aligned with the international carbon price, but most importantly, this should take into consideration the South Africa's unique economic circumstances. Then moving forward to the recommendation with regards to the proposed carbon tax rate trajectory, which is set on a US dollar currency. Here, the critical recommendation that we are making is that the carbon tax rate should be set in South Africa's rand, and perhaps National Treasury look at continuing to levy carbon tax rate on an annual basis with the CPI plus 2% in the first phase. And if there is any potential increases in the carbon tax rate, this should be accompanied by additional measures that will assist and support the mining industry. For an example, incentives, grants, allowances, etc. I will now hand over to Mr. Bongani Mosa, who is the senior economist at the Minerals Council, to take you through the some initial analysis that we've done to understand the financial impact of the carbon tax on the mining industry. Thank you.
Unfortunately, Ms. Mudai, you haven't left Bongani any time at all to do his part. That is unfortunate. But I hope the part that he was going to present has been captured in writing to Treasury.
Yes.
Thank you so much. I want to thank Mineral Council for their input. Now we are with Cement and Concrete SA. Thank you, Sisi. I'm sorry for that. Okay, Cement and Concrete SA, you have your 10 minutes. We start now.
Thank you. Hello. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, sir. You can go ahead. Thank you.
Yes, I'm just trying to load my presentation. Thank you, Chair. I trust you can see the presentation and you can hear me.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Good day, Honorable Chair and members. Thanks for the opportunity to present. I represent the major cement producers in the country, and I will present some of the challenges that we face with the new proposed draft amendments. Just as an introduction, the CCSA is an association that champions environmental stewardship, health and safety practices, community and stakeholder interaction to ensure that the members are indeed taking the journey of sustainable development. Furthermore, I think our members do take note of the entire value chain from end to end, that is from mining of the limestone right up to the cement production and concrete production subsequent to that, to ensure sustainable buildings. And also along the value chain, we look at the socioeconomic impacts, potential use of waste materials to preserve non-renewable resources, and also ensure job creation and a just transition during our journey to reduce GHG targets. Furthermore, I think we are committed to South Africa's nationally determined contribution under the Paris Agreement. And as you'll see on our website, we have committed to a sectoral net zero vision for cement production by 2050. It's quite an ambition journey, particularly from the fact that cement production is a very hard to abate sector. At the onset, we'd like to acknowledge National Treasury for the work towards their future carbon tax regime, which is, I think, very commendable. The current effort to align different legislations is encouraging. It's quite difficult, I think, but they've certainly managed to look at some of the alignments with the GHG reporting regulation, the carbon budgets, etc. So there's still some work to be done, but I think there is some work taking place, and we appreciate that. In terms of, we'd also like to acknowledge Department of Environment, Forestry and Fisheries for aligning the GHG reporting requirements to support the carbon tax implementation and also supporting alignment of different policy instruments, including the carbon pricing policy. So as a policy in terms of carbon tax, I think the CCSA recognizes the use of carbon pricing and carbon tax as an important policy instrument. So that's quite important. However, I think in terms of our cement industry, it is important that members note that the cement sector is most capital intensive, it is most energy intensive, it is also most carbon intensive. This is mainly due to more than half of our emissions coming from limestone, which is as a result of chemistry and which can't be really mitigated if you're using limestone. And then I think a second major contributor of GHG emissions is our thermal heat. South Africa is coal dependent in terms of energy, and more than 40% of our GHG emissions come from coal energy. So I think we have a complex sector here, which is hard to abate, and this is recognized internationally. I think in addition to that, as I mentioned, which is a very hard to abate sector, and therefore there are very limited mitigation opportunities. But I'd like to add that we have begun our journey on reducing GHG emissions over 10 years ago, and we do compare favorably in many respects internationally. One of the other problems we have is trade exposure. There are cheap imports taking place, and this certainly has an impact on our viability in the country. Domestic production capacity is quite low. I think at the moment we are producing or selling 50% of our capacity of 22.7 million tons. And then we have about 1 million tons being imported. So I think it's a stressed environment from a business perspective. We also contribute quite a bit to the regional economic development. For example, the limestone mines are located in selected hubs in the country. Lichtenhoek hub is an important area, and much of the regional economic development does depend on the cement sector for employment and other matters. I think another important area is sustainable development and resilience. Is an important focus area of our members. So I think although we agree with carbon pricing, we believe that the $20 and $30 is very, very steep, and National Treasury should review the numbers. But should the $20 and $30 be retained, I think we have major concerns regarding probably the allowances that would be kept or taken away. I think the first one is electricity price neutrality commitment is only until 2025. So there will be a price throughput from electricity, and that's going to increase our electricity price in terms of production costs. Trade exposure, as I mentioned previously, we're going to have loss of competitiveness because of cheap imports. Although trade exposure has been reflected in the budget speech where allowance is increased from 30 to 50% for trade exposure, however, we're not sure what the bans would look like from 50%, and it is very likely that cement sector once again may not enjoy the full trade exposure allowance as is the case presently. So I think that pass-through of electricity is an area important. The trade exposure is another important area. Process allowances, the budget speech was silent on process allowances. As I've indicated, more than 50% comes from chemistry, which cannot be mitigated, and therefore I think there needs to be a special arrangement for sectors such as cement, where hard-to-abate sectors cannot really mitigate process allowance by 2030. Just to give you an idea about the current tax rates that have been proposed, the carbon tax included in the variable cost of sales, if you just look at the variable cost, it's going to increase by tenfold by 2030, and this certainly is not sustainable and viable for the cement producers. This would basically translate to a price increase of 6 to 8% above CPI by 2030, which I think is also hard for consumers. So if the sector would be unable to pass this through to consumers, the domestic industry would be more uncompetitive relative to imports, and it would be unsustainable to continue operating. And this is notwithstanding the best efforts to carbonize in terms of our commitment to net zero by 2050. So in summary, I think what I'd like to say is that the rapidly increasing carbon tax rate, the rapidly increasing electricity price, as we're seeing, the rapidly increasing coal price, the greenhouse gas mitigation effort costs, the lack of government grants and imminent removal of the various allowances or deductions could have major implications to the viability of the cement industry in South Africa. So we'd like to say that the principle of common but differentiated responsibility has been noted, as South Africa is a developing country and South Africa is vulnerable to cheap imports. While we often refer to the EU, it is to be noted that the EU is well advanced and ahead of the curve and have enjoyed many incentives in the past to decarbonize over many years, more than 10 years. And thus they're able to determine standards and benchmarks which are very ambitious for South Africa. A case in point is the adoption of these benchmarks for cement in the South African green taxonomy. We are not sure how these benchmarks would be interpreted by the financial institutions in South Africa. And therefore, once again, the benchmarks may pose a challenge in terms of our mitigation cost curves. The CCSA members support our NDC and notes that it is based on various conditions being met to support our mitigation actions. While we consider and recognize carbon tax a policy instrument, its implementation must consider challenges facing the hard-to-abate sectors and provide an enabling environment to ensure sustainability of the cement sector. So I think in the conclusion, Chair, I'd like to say that the work done by National Treasury towards the future carbon tax regime is commendable in terms of various alignments taking place. And I think the trajectory noted, although we are not happy with the rates, the current effort to align different legislations is encouraging. The current effort to promote ease of doing business without compromising the environment, ensuring sustainable development goals, is noted. The national submitted NDC relies on appropriate technical, technological, and fiscal support, and I think National Treasury needs to take note of this, particularly for the hard-to-abate sectors. So what we would like to recommend that the National Treasury note the challenges facing our hard-to-abate sector, which is also the most capital-intensive, most energy-intensive, carbon-intensive, and vulnerable to cheap imports. Consider the principle of differentiated approach to allowances for the hard-to-abate sectors. They facilitate fiscal support for appropriate mitigation actions. Internationally, the hard-to-abate sectors are looking at carbon capture and storage, which could go into billions of dollars. I'm not sure.
Cut to the chase, please.
Thank you. I'll be a minute.
Cut to the chase.
Yes. Cement sector requires extensive support on allowances and incentives to remain in business. The rapidly increasing tax rates, etc., I think needs to be addressed. And I think we need to note that the internationally cement producers enjoy significant allowances, and the carbon, published carbon price rate certainly may not be effective price and actual cost to business. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much to the Cement and Concrete SA. I want to really appreciate the problem that's facing you, because time is always an enemy. Thank you so much for your presentation. Now we give over to ITT.
Thank you.
To see. Your 10 minutes, ITC, it's Andrew's host.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chair, and good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for the opportunity to present the industry task team on climate change comments. So in terms of, I'm Dr. Andrew Schuyls, and I'm the co-vice chair of the IPCC. The IPCC represents the energy intensive industries that will likely be affected by carbon tax significantly. And overall, our general position is that we support decarbonization of the economy, and we would like to commend the government for the ambitious NDC that has been put forward as the guiding beacon to achieve the decarbonization. And we also acknowledge the role that an effective carbon price, carbon tax plays as part of penalties and incentives to reach this, and we therefore support that this price should be carefully implemented with a trajectory that is complemented with several incentives. But it remains essential that it does not come at the expense of industry that is currently in transition and the realization of a just transition for our economy. So in terms of our submission, we want to first highlight the impact that the proposed rate increases could have on the economy as well as industry. As everyone's aware, South Africa's economy and the industry currently attempts to recover from the impact of COVID-19. And the proposed carbon tax rate introduces a highly punitive tax rate that provides little relief measures that support it. So we as industry see that this proposed uplift in the tax rate is a bit too soon and high for the industry to absorb at this moment, and this could lead to unintended consequences. Some of the internal modeling by some of our members showed that they might prematurely have to shut down some or all of the operations, and this could also lead to some critical services or products being replaced by imports. This was also mentioned for the cement industry, where there is cheaper products available from outside. So this would mean that the import countries where the products are imported from will get the benefit to their economy and not necessarily South Africa. Then to also, as mentioned for by the cement industry, we would also suggest that a single national carbon price across all sectors is not necessarily the best way to approach this, since carbon price gives the signal to switch to lower carbon processes or substitute for different products. But different sectors, different industries, and different technologies will each have different prices that need to be understood to achieve this transition. So the IPCC's proposal is that for the extended third phase, the carbon price should still increase with the CPI plus 2% as mentioned in the Carbon Tax Act currently, and that a study be conducted on the feasibility of implementing a sector-based carbon tax design as opposed to a general national carbon price. Then we also support and appreciate the extension of the Section 12 our energy incentive. However, the viability of this incentive we feel should be reviewed, since the rate hasn't been increased since its implementation, and the extended end date still ultimately indicates that it might fall away leaving little to no way to currently receive the carrot side of the equation and only beaten by the stick while we're running the comrades. So currently there is limited alternative support available for us to decarbonize and to follow a just transition. There is several alternative measures available, like implementing standards or regulations on the efficiency of materials and the carbon content, having ring fencing the carbon tax income and all those things. But ultimately, we feel there should be more support towards decarbonization and the just transition. So our proposal is that the Section 12, our energy efficiency incentive, should be reviewed to ensure that remains a viable and attractive option for industry, while also expanding the measures that is available to industry to decarbonize. Then a third point was also touched on by other submitters, and that's the electricity carbon price neutrality that we currently experience, and we appreciate the extension of it until the end of 2025. However, this pass-through poses a significant financial risk for energy-intensive industries as well as the general public. In the end, this will lead to a double taxation for industry, since they'll be liable for their own carbon tax and that of electricity supplier if a carbon tax can be passed through. Eskom has already noted in their annual report that this might be a 4-5% increase on the year-on-year tariff just related to carbon tax. And modeling by one of our members shows that the pass-through can exceed 250 per kilowatt hour of electricity in 2030 if the current rates of $50 by 2030 is implemented. And also, all sectors cannot pass through or has a limited pass through available to them on the carbon tax. This is due to several reasons, such as customer affordability, if we look at the electricity sector, regulated fuel prices for liquid fuels, and that the mining sector receives their prices from external factors and they are not in control of it. So overall, we propose an in-depth study to determine the impact and consequences of a carbon tax pass-through from the electricity sector, as well as analyze the impact on sectors that are not able to pass through carbon tax to their customers. We also support the inclusion of sequestration activities in the carbon tax formula, but we would like to propose that this be extended to all sectors and not only keep it limited to the paper and pulp industry to benefit from it. This will allow multiple sectors and companies to use the land and assets within their control to also receive this benefit. Then the final two points of our submission supports that of previous submissions, where we propose that the carbon tax should be put forward in South African rand terms just to eliminate the uncertainty that comes with having it stated as a US dollar, which is highly unpredictable due to numerous factors and requires complex strategies to adopt hedging and having taken into account the general volatility of the international world. Then finally, we would like to let the draft TLAB please just mention that the carbon, or that the current allowances will be maintained, since there was discussions with during the budget speech that will fall away. It's unclear on what's expected, and the climate change bill currently being considered proposes changes to the allowances and the associated tax rate, but there's currently no indication of how everything will fit together in the end and even to what point things will be retained. So in conclusion, the ITTCC supports a well-implemented carbon price as mechanism towards realizing South Africa's commitments towards climate change. We aim to highlight concerns and make recommendations to improve the carbon tax aspects that's included in the C-Lab, and with that, I would like to thank you for the opportunity.
Okay. Thank you so much, Dr. Andres Rose, for that input by ITTCC. And now we're off to the Chemical and Allied Industries Association. The Chemical and Allied Industries Association. Over to you. Your 10 minutes starts now.
Thank you, sir. I'm just going to share my screen. You see my screen, sir?
Yes, we can see your screen. Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the Honourable Members for the opportunity to present CAIA's inputs today on the draft TDAB relating to the Carbon Tax Act proposals and amendments. My name is Ben Malhuber. I'm Head of Policy Analysis at the Chemical and Allied Industries Association. The chemical industry really touches every part of the economy, Chair. We are a strong contributor to manufacturing as well as gross domestic product and employment, and we show a strong multiplier effect both downstream and upstream in the economy from these contributions. So we are an integral sector to both upstream and downstream parts of the economy. The intention of, sorry, I need to change slide. The intention of CAIA's policy engagements with government is to assist with crafting the most effective least cost policy to drive the reduction in greenhouse gas emissions with as little negative impact on business sustainability, employment, and GDP as possible said. Although it's recognized that South Africa's greenhouse gas emissions are one of the highest in the world per capita, they also appear to have peaked, Chair, if you look at the recent draft 8th National Greenhouse Gas Emissions reporting inventory that was recently published for comment. Given this, if you also take that the direct chemical industry, industrial process and product use greenhouse gas emissions don't feature much in this national inventory, we're sitting really at a contribution of about 1% of the national inventory. We therefore feel that it's important that there need to be differential pressures applied with the carbon tax as it appears to be continuing to be implemented, and as much flexibility as possible needs to be provided. We think by reconsidering allowances and also increasing the flexibility of offsetting opportunities to a very, very large degree. These differential pressures that we speak about here could be informed by analyzing least cost mitigation, which can be seen through the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and Environment's work a number of years ago that has since been updated twice to reflect mitigation potential in different sectors of the economy. There really, really needs to be a strong, much stronger intergovernmental approach to these climate change related engagements, and there needs to be stronger stakeholder participations in working towards achieving the country's needs and to contribute to a global solution. And this can really only happen through more engagement here than is currently taking place, both with stakeholders in the market and intergovernmentally. Just because of time, I'm going to skip through some slides. What we would like to address next is with the tax trajectory proposed at the moment, Chair, we feel that only bookend scenarios can be estimated if we consider zero allowances in the very short term being a reality. There's no allowance information and there's no carbon budget methodology finalization from the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and Environment So it becomes very difficult in this system that should be integrated to be able to refine estimates. And this leads, as you'll see a little bit later, to assumptions of severe impacts, which are compounded when possible mitigation is limited. And we'll speak to that a little bit later. So I draw your attention to that. Tax liability, Chair, will ultimately in the second phase be dependent on where carbon budget is set and the rate of the tax above and or below the budget. Tax below the budget being a important policy discussion that we need to take forward quite urgently, as the Carbon Tax Act at the moment only deals with the taxation of all relevant emissions. Other matters that we feel are very important to be finalised as soon as possible to add to investor and regulatory certainty is the matter of annualisation between the link with the carbon budget and the carbon tax. We don't know how that is going to be reconciled on an annual basis because of tax policy, while the carbon budget cycle is on a five-year period. How do we ensure that there's sufficient cash flow to be able to ensure our liabilities and our responsibilities? Secondly, how are legislative amendments also linked with the National Greenhouse Gas Emissions Reporting Regulations going to be resolved, because there's a lag between these TLAB, TELAB processes and the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and Environment's Greenhouse Gas Reporting Regulation update, and we have a proposal for that as well later. The point here, Chair, is that these may not be urgent considerations for government, and we have raised them before, but they most certainly are important considerations for business right now. Based on the information available, Chair, companies are estimating dire consequences for this rate that's currently proposed being implemented. They are estimating 9 times, 12 times, 75 times, 250% increases in carbon tax liability by 2030, and this isn't even considering the trajectory to 2050. These estimates were received from CAI member companies that are relatively small greenhouse gas emitters. And Chair, please stress that most of the members that have carbon tax liability have already mitigated greenhouse gas emissions to a large degree. Some are even operating best in their class from a global perspective. Furthermore, these greenhouse gas emissions are from sectors that form a minority of the country's emissions. The following are just a few of many paraphrased examples of the sentiment that CAI is fielding, and we really need to consider this in terms of businesses will close. It's going to impact competitiveness, employment, poverty. How low is low enough? Because we've done what we can do. We've already implemented the feasible mitigation in the market. We cannot pursue growth and capital investment. These are just some of pages of inputs received. So these sentiments show that the tax and its trajectory, along with uncertainty, Chair, is further eroding investor confidence and business sustainability. Companies that are already doing what they can or have implemented ongoing projects to reduce greenhouse gas emissions voluntarily should be reconsidered for inclusion in the tax net. And this can simply be done by de-linking the greenhouse gas regulations to carbon tax liability and fully implementing what Treasury really wanted, that was to see the tax on the big emitters where there can be mitigation. One must remember, Chair, that the greenhouse gas national inventory is meant to be as comprehensive as possible to capture all emissions for the country, and that wasn't the intention of the tax. Companies who have already mitigated emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, to the extent possible, Chair, they are part of the Responsible Care Initiative. It's a voluntary initiative of the chemical industry, and they have good track records in sustainability. So just in short, I'd like to speak to the last slide. We've mentioned all the most important points, Chair. So I'd just like to highlight the need for further engagement. Just go to that slide. We'd like to highlight the need for further engagement, Chair. We need to focus on ensuring that growth is possible for the country given this policy. We need to de-link the text from the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and Environment's greenhouse gas reporting regulations. We support that it's de-linked from the US exchange rate because it adds to uncertainty. And the full mitigation system needs to be put on the table by government so that there can be further engagement, including on a much more flexible offsetting policy and ring-fencing policy by Treasury. And we're happy to engage further. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much to Mr. Glenn Malhepe from SAISA. Thank you for the presentation. And I will give over to our last presenter from the stakeholders, Mr. Spenig.
Thank you, Chair. Just from ArcelorMittal, we just like to put our presentation.
Can you get it?
Can you hear me?
Oh yes, go ahead.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Good afternoon, everybody. Dear Honourable Chairman and Honourable Members of this Committee, I wish to thank you for the opportunity to comment on the Draft Taxation Laws Amendment Bill. CLAP, I am Werner Venter, the Chief Technical Officer of ArcelorMittal South Africa, and we are also part of the ArcelorMittal International Group. On our first slide, ArcelorMittal South Africa is the largest steel producer in South Africa with integrated facilities that convert iron ore to steel located in Gauteng, KwaZulu-Natal and in the Western Cape, where unfortunately our operations are mothballed due to unsustainability. Our parent company conducts steel making operations in various jurisdictions globally, and ArcelorMittal International participate in the corresponding carbon markets where they exist. The conversion of iron to steel relies on the use of coal as a reductant, and our direct Scope 1 greenhouse gas emissions per annum is significant. But we are very excited about alternative technologies that's currently being researched, and it's envisaged that a meaningful reduction in greenhouse gas will be achieved through the application of these various technologies on a large and a very hopefully a feasibility scale. AMSA, specifically, we have developed our own roadmap to reduce the greenhouse gas, to set targets for 2030, as well as set targets for net zero for 2050. Our ArcelorMittal International Group also have clear communicated targets of about 25% by 2030 and net zero by 2050 as well. Currently, we are already in feasibility as well as development of certain of our projects in South Africa that we want to implement, as well as across the globe from ArcelorMittal International. It is evident that National Treasury wish to steer South Africa in a direction of high carbon prices, similar to the few jurisdictions elsewhere in the world where we operate. What we are every hour seeing is that high carbon prices are now considered in isolation without understanding the wider context of which they are implemented elsewhere. Our comments mention various examples, especially from regions where we operate in the EU and Canada, to illustrate that the proclaimed carbon tax is not the price that's being paid in the end, due to various allowances that are afforded to energy-intensive and hard-to-abate sectors, which are also prone to carbon leakage. Such allowances will continue beyond 2030 elsewhere, in contrast to South Africa, where the minister has stated the allowance will rapidly fall away towards 2030. The bill unfortunately only stipulates high carbon prices going forward till 2030, but it quite but it's silent on the allowances, which creates major uncertainty for all of us that has commented today. We would definitely rely on allowances beyond 2030 to remain sustainable, as most alternative technologies is currently being researched only for the steel industry and may only become feasible and really available beyond 2030, even closer to 2035. We also need grants and subsidies in addition, like we see elsewhere in the world. For an example, the US has in August, where there's currently no carbon, they've proclaimed in August, they have announced that the state support in the form of grants and tax breaks relating to decarbonization initiatives. When you look in South Africa, in some places we say that the Section 12L of the Income Tax Act relating to energy efficiency may offer relief from a decarbonization perspective, but the opposite rather is true, that when you decarbonize the steel industry, you might need as much as four times the amount of electricity that you will need. In our second slide, in case of ArcelorMittal with scope 1 emissions in excess of about 10 million tons per annum, the tax liability with the allowance being phased out by 2030 is a scary number of billions per year. Even if we reduce our carbon emissions by 50%, the number is still extreme in the billions of rands. Most certainly, further thought needs to go into how important sectors like iron and steel, and also from the others that is mentioned today, to get alive, as our products will remain important for this transition in South Africa to take place. AMSA need to invest in alternative energy. We need to invest in alternative processes, and we will then have the requirement also to pay the extreme high carbon tax, and this will make us not sustainable. Our sector is also seeing a lot of steel being imported into the country from jurisdictions where no carbon price or only a low carbon price is being levied. Imports amount to roughly 30% of local consumption. Steel is also found in many finished goods, for an example, spades, wheelbarrows, where there's no carbon being considered at the moment. With the proposed increase in carbon prices, our competitiveness is seriously compromised. Carbon prices needs to be implemented cautiously till a broader implementation of carbon prices is witnessed on a global scale on imported products. Protectionist measures like carbon border adjustments could be an option, and which are being debated in various jurisdictions globally, also in the areas where we participate globally. In conclusion, Chair, we find the TLAB totally lacking from a support measure perspective. And with such undertaking being created, an important sector is put at risk, not to even mention future investments. We trust that the draft TLAB will be amended to take our concerns on board, and that South African carbon tax structures is more aligned to what is experienced elsewhere across the globe, and take into consider our own unique circumstances, like the lack of electricity, lack of green energy, the lack of green hydrogen, and many other critical factors that in time we will have to overcome to assist us with the decarbonization journeys that we have embarked on. Thank you so much, Chair.
Thank you so much to ArcelorMittal for that presentation. It means a lot that stakeholders are able to come to the committee and make these presentations, so that when Treasury comes with response, we are also able to be the mouth of the various stakeholders that have presented in the committee, just like the chairperson has done on the issue of the currency, for example. And I can see that the honorable members do not have comments or questions to make, and probably that is also due to the fact that we have run out of time. However, once again, we just want to thank the various stakeholders for their input here today, and the treasury is also part of this platform, apart from the fact that you also have written to them on the various issues that you want to raise on both the TELEP and the TELEP. Can we check for announcements? Deboho?
Sorry for that. Next week, Tuesday, we'll be getting responses from National Treasury on the raised bill. And on Wednesday, we'll be getting responses from National Treasury for TELEP and TELEP. So the next... Can you hear me, ma'am?
I can hear you, Tebogo, loud and clear.
Oh, yes.
We have a meeting on Tuesday and another one on Wednesday.
Yes.
But for TELEP and TELEP, it's Wednesday.
Yes.
So it's the raised bill on Tuesday.
Yes, ma'am.
That is loud and clear. Thank you so much. I want to thank you, Tebogo, and the officials, all the officials from the legislature, the stakeholders that have taken the time to come and present, honorable members, as well as treasury that is part of this kind of meeting. Thank you so much. We hope you have a good day. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks, everybody.
For sure. Malibu,